Okay, I'm on the phone with Alton Benes, and it is Saturday, June 30th, 2:42 p.m. Hawaii time. And Alton's been sending me some interesting private emails, and it's too much to type and respond, so I want to talk through them with him. So welcome to Dobbstown, Alton.
Thanks, Bob.
So, looking at the first one that you sent me on June 11th, Bob, yeah. Permit me to address an interpretation of a philosophical system which may hitherto have scarcely been covered. The presentation of such an advanced system in unencrypted form is a generous and noble concern. Now, where did I unencrypt it? Are you talking about my discussions about Fatty Communion?
Well, you know, leaving the RNA drops aside, I thought your basic platform was that you were going to be basically an open book, and I can't remember the word you used, but it sounded to me like the idea was that you were going—you had no secrets, essentially. I mean, it's certainly not. I mean, certainly in terms of the diaries. I mean, it's basically,
yes.
You know, a secret history of the 20th century, you know, that you told.
Yes.
And you talk about Galen and these guys, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's some names you haven't mentioned, but what you've said already is enough, you know, to keep the academics running around for a long time. So, I mean, the idea
right.
that...
So you're talking about what I wrote in my diaries, what I've said in some interviews. It's a general statement about my way of talking.
Yeah, there's another aspect that I think I meant by that, and that's that the way fame is manufactured and celebrity within artistic circles, publishing, you know, and novels and everything. Yeah, I mean, obviously the extreme example is Pynchon, who has basically, you know, encrypted his own history.
Yes.
And but it creates a mystique, and so it sells a lot of books.
Yeah.
And you've kind of done the opposite of that, whereas you've basically told all using, you know, tactile media, you know, you've using all forms of media just to get the information out there. And not too concerned about either form or encrypting it, or encrypting your own history, creating mystique, in other words.
Right,
other
or
words,
even charging for it. It's
yeah.
all for free. And, yeah, so that the thing, it's the very way to lose a lot of listeners, because people are going to say, well, if this guy's telling the truth, he would have been killed a long time ago. Or... Why would this guy want to do all this? He's trying to get attention. So there's a lot of disservices to be so open, right?
Well, I mean, you can look at it as a disservice, but it's just that old McLuhan thing about how only puny secrets need protection, that the big secrets are protected by public incredulity, and that is as true now as Socrates was around, so... Nobody really wants the truth. People are really, really afraid of the truth.
Yep. They're afraid of the violence that will happen to their identity.
Absolutely. But I think part of your point was that, and certainly McLuhan's point, you know, was that what the bomb is information means is that private identity is gone. I mean, you can try to recreate it or have an illusion that it's there, but, you know, I don't know if anybody can actually prove it. So
that's right. So then you say it bespeaks a lack of ego, which cares not for worldly gain. That is true, because I already had enough money on that level to not benefit much if I got a lot more money. You know, I had enough to, I'm covered. What do they call it? I had a lot of fuck you money. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
And then it says, and as history has taught us, the latter is achieved through deception, that's worldly gain, deception, encryption, smoke and mirrors, etc. Joyce was aware that he ensured his immortality via the puzzles written into the wake. But your platform of universal revealing or revelation does invite endgame, or as the case may be in terms of eternal shishness, which is consciousness without the C-O-N. As the case may be in terms of eternal shishness, transition game strategies for those who are exposed to it. Now, at the time I asked you, what did you mean by endgame? So let's define that. My revelation and revealing and my openness invites endgame. I guess you mean it's a challenge, right? If it's true what I'm saying, it's a challenge. Is that what you mean by endgame?
Well, you're talking, and when we had this conversation, when we had a conversation about this email a few weeks ago, we used the term eschatological, which is the wrong term. It's really not eschatological. Nor is it even what you would call apocalyptic. I think both of those terms are wrong. Essentially, so that's why it's more of a transition. In other words, what you're talking about is ascension, essentially. And that term has also been, you know, defined various ways, if not abused. So, and it's a controversial term, but there's a way to characterize this in terms of seeing it as the end of history. So in that sense, it's an end game. And necessitates this strategizing about what to do now that sort of a revealing has occurred. In other words, and then, but I mean, obviously, that's an extremely, you know, complex topic. But if, you know, some people talk about dimensional shifts and different things like that. But what I'm interested in is understanding, like, the implications of a sort of a tell-all system. Not necessarily. I mean, the term whistleblower has been applied, but I think that that's a misappropriated term as well. But it's basically you've basically done a tell-all about you know, the history of thought, and so the question is, and I mean, obviously, it goes beyond thought, but you know, the human project, right? And so everybody, you know, I mean, people have ideas about what's the endgame scenario for the human project, and what I wanted to get into is. I guess when I started this was the idea, and we'll get into it as the email continues, but about what the Rai and everything like that.
Yes.
In other words, what do humans, what is the activity that's going on now that the cobwebs of Rai are there? Like, what is the basic function? You know, and obviously, you know, it could be slack. I mean, there may not be a function. But that's the question. What's the strategy for the end game? Basically?
Transition game strategies. Okay, so that's what you mean. Transition game strategies for those who are exposed to it. Now, why do you put shishness rather than consciousness?
Oh, well, that's the whole percept concept thing that,
okay.
that McLuhan got into, and I think it was William James's term originally, right? I'm reading that.
Yeah, I think McLuhan used it.
Yeah.
So it's more perceptual being rather than some concept of consciousness. So you drop the con.
Well, actually, that's a good way to put it. You drop the con, literally and figuratively, and you're left with, because you don't have to create concepts anymore because they've outlived their usefulness. So you just have perceptivity, and the question is, what do you do with that?
Right. So. You could even think of that as shush. You know how you shush someone to be quiet? It could be the post in questing silence, shushness, kind of silence. Well, that's good. Okay, so the next paragraph. The simplest scenario is the following. And granted, I haven't achieved familiarity with your entire IRV, but a substantial amount of it nonetheless. So here's the scenario. If everything you've reported about Rai and Isis is taken literally, including your own identification with the former, that identification is only on the dupes forum as a simulated dialogue about Ion. And so I'm the ostensible originator of the Ion thing. So that's what I meant by Ion. So it was tongue in cheek. I definitely am not not what am I saying? I was Rai, tongue in cheek. I was Rai. Definitely, I'm not Rai in person or in operation. But within that world,
right.
And
sure,
I gave Carolyn the name Isis. She doesn't even engage in the forum, but just we're partners, been together a long time. So if anybody's going to play the role of Rai and Isis, we could do it. So it was only in the sense of a game, but certainly
Well, you can
not,
look at it as simulation, absolutely. But I was, just for either for the sake of argument or for a simple logical extension. I wanted to look at the problem in that sense because it does tie in with things you've said previously about under Android mean conditions and everything that, I don't know if you were even, you might have been tongue-in-cheek about this too, but that you and Connie were the only people, only live beings or whatever.
We're the only one, we were the first to reappear.
Right.
And that we said that in 1995. Okay, so we can go into that a little later. So you say, if everything you report about Rai and Isis is taken literally, including your own identification with the former, the Bodhisattva paradigm is able to be invoked, in which case you could be seen as returning to essence. In brackets, recall your conversation with David Worster wherein he mentions Buddha having been the closest to drawing human attention toward getting off the wheel. That's in parentheses. Then you say, so, in decrypting the history-long cult of personality and demystifying all of its hallowed hierarchies and thought systems, you have effectively put on the separateness in order to show all beings who think they perceive separateness that is actually their own creation. Okay, so that's how I'm mirroring Rai's function back. Okay, you've said that there. However, during the interval in which this particular awareness on the part of the other moves through the stages of perception to conception to causal agent of action, the temptation does exist for people to encrypt your insights and remarket them back to the cults of personality or delusion which exists in the world. I agree. I can easily see how you might find this type of behavior objectionable. I generally don't find much objectionable because I agree with McLuhan that we're in such a strange environment, value judgments don't serve at least the beginning points of trying to define what's happening. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Well,
you know,
Eugene
Krishnamurti had a kind of little spin on this too. When he was speaking and people were videotaping him and everything like that. And I think there's some things on YouTube with him on there. You know, he says basically, you can do whatever you want with, what I've said. You can print it, sell it, burn it, whatever. You know, he didn't really care because for him, the mind was a myth, this whole realm, it didn't really matter.
I said the same thing back in the late 80s, and that's why the albums got made. They didn't have to worry about copyright or anything with me. They just put them out.
Yeah.
I said you could do whatever you want. A lot of those YouTubes, any footage of UG Krishnamurti, who's the anti-Jiddu Krishnamurti or anti-the-famous Golden Boy Krishnamurti, those were done by Robert Carr, and I think you've listened to the Robert Carr interviews. And he's the one who did a lot of that taping. He was a good friend of UG's. Just for the record, you can listen to Robert Carr.
Yeah,
Carr's.
I started looking at some of his Godman Conman book, and the interview with that you did with him and David Worster. That was I listened to some of that. It was kind of rambling. It's long.
Right.
I
would suggest hear it all. It's two opposite personalities coming together.
Yeah, absolutely. Bob Carr, he's got his own thing out there, Dave Worster's got his,
Right.
Trying to bring the two together. Yeah, well, that is the most interesting thing about it. Seattle and the Center for Awareness and that Agyananda, Leopold Fisher was his name, fascinating.
Yeah.
That book, The Ochre Robe, I haven't looked into that yet, but. All that stuff about Ramakrishna, and it's too, ridiculous to believe. But, I'd like to research it, find out. And the other thing he was talking about with that Monty West, he was a fascinating figure, too, that guy, the Australian Aborigines,
Anyway,
yeah,
we could actually call up Dave together and tape him, and you could ask him about some of these people if you wanted more detail from him.
Yeah, I think that's certainly, and maybe in the future, yeah, we can do
yeah.
that. So I'd have to, you know, get like my Walter Bauer list of questions together, because you know, I want it to move along, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, with Dave, it will move anyways. It may not go the directions you want, and it's good
to bounce
off with your questions. But the thing is it's good to bring up these topics with Dave, because it'll tap into his memory that no one's accessed for a long time, and he had no reason to say it. You just evoke it. You know, he remembers things. That's what's useful about it. He suddenly thinks of things he hasn't thought of in 50 years, because he has a pretty good memory if you get him going. Okay, so I see, yeah, you're saying, all right, so we're talking about putting, what is the Bodhisattva paradigm? How do you define that?
Well, the Bodhisattva can basically walk into nirvana, but he chooses not to before having saved, or not saved, but before having seen everyone else become enlightened.
Right.
I mean, I don't
right.
necessarily
now,
agree with it, but it is a model of life, basically, or you know, existence.
Right. Now, here's Ion said to me very early, and this showed the awareness, the understanding of Ion. I mean, I don't think anybody would ever even think of saying this about Worcester. No one had before to me. Ion said that Worcester wants everybody to get it. That would be the Bodhisattva paradigm. But Ion says, for itself, they're not interested in everybody getting it. And Ion said, that is the difference between Dave and us. And that was a very interesting statement, because most people have the sentiment of wanting everybody to get there, right? Can't we all get along? We all get there. It's interesting that Ion will let many go aside, you know, heck with them,
right.
You know, they're not going to make it. And
yeah,
you know,
well, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if they're going to go transition, and he says many will transition in this period, they go to the GOP, they're going to come back here and have eternity by default. So he almost says he'd rather work with those that are conscious of the process. Those are going to get their eternity in a somnambulist state he's not interested in. You got no problem with them. They don't bother Ion. And when we say he, we mean they, the whole dodecahedron of the GOP, that is Ion, but we say he for brevity. So that was the first time made me think about what Worcester was doing and what the difference with Ion. No one had ever positioned themselves different from Dave, you know? So that was good.
Uh-huh.
That was a good point. So, but you're right. Your interpretation of the Bodhisattva paradigm, that's what Worcester is about, getting everybody there.
Right. Well, the other thing, though, the point about that is, I mean, I guess one of this kind of email kind of led into that whole Wakeian stage post, which gets into scenarios for the guff emptying as it pertains to cryptography, right? But it's interesting that, yes, in Ion scenario, you know, it kind of, maybe it's sort of like, I don't want to, you know, assume, but it's like there is no there, like the Dorothy Parker thing. There is no getting it, really. I mean, that's what Yuji Krishnamurti talked about. You know, there is no enlightenment. It's all
right.
A con. And so in that sense, but Worcester did explicitly talk about the Bodhisattva thing. And
yes.
He seems to align his thinking with Buddhism, you know, in a way. He said in that talk, and I think he posted on Five Body in transcript form. But
yes.
he talks about that the Buddha was, I think he used the word, that's the whole freaking point, or used that phrase.
Yeah.
Get off the wheel. But, you know, it's Ion seems to be more graphic in his descriptions of the celebratory aspect of it.
The wheel.
When it happens.
In the wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah, being.
Right.
I won't make too much effort to get off the wheel. Enjoy the wheel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And that would be a way of getting off on it, is not to resist it, but to get into it. And I think Ian does want. He has said, eventually, you know, that all desire is limited. So he
right.
becomes traditional sometimes in his thought patterns, but it always depends on who he's talking to. He's
right.
a great juggler of perspectives and ratios and angles on things, and I like that. I think that's a more appropriate strategy for our quadraphenic world we live in, because we're all forced to juggle so much today, including bodies.
Right.
So
yeah.
the agility of that is the skills required, you know. And Ion is probably, there's probably never been a fount of information, whatever you want to call Ion, that is so tenuous, negotiable, dismissible of what it had said, and always, you could say, maybe so process-oriented, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Don't know any, I mean, my previous people didn't have the speed of communication to do it in, you know, the speed of technology,
right.
but... Ian is certainly resonant with the style demanded of our time.
Right.
You can see
you
can see McLuhan was good at that. He began that trend. You know, Krishnamurti, UG Krishnamurti, anybody, Gurdjieff, would have been too slow today.
Right.
If they were the way they were back in the 20s and 30s and 40s.
Right.
Though some people might, they like the idea of getting off the wheel, and they would like a Krishnamurti who's slow, and you can go to a retreat with them, right? But Ion and Cosmic Awareness, the Evergreens, understood that there was a merging of there and here and inner and outer, so it would be pretty hard to find a retreat to get that vacuum or that space to develop in isolation. And that's why I see Ion engaging right in the middle of everything, just getting on there and doing a talk show. There is no source that has done as many talk shows as Ion and claimed to be, you know, non-physical. That's pretty neat. Okay,
right.
That's just a side
well, real
thing.
Quick, real,
yeah.
real quick, when you mentioned that, you know, the Ion stance, you know, you were talking about desire, it made me think of this one of the Phoenix Source distribution things I read the other day with Commander Hatton. He talked about, now this is obviously, you know, he's got several scribes, and, you know, it's very controversial, and there's a lot of infighting between the Eckers and the bell ringers and all these people. But he said one really interesting thing when he was talking about they were defining the Holy Spirit. And he was sort of going and redefining a lot of terms that are used in Christian theology. And he said that spirit is desire, which I thought was very interesting in this context.
And I agree with that. And Ion seemed to be saying that for many months. And many people in the rewrite group knew he was saying that. And then one day he said, no, desire is not transcendence, or you know, it wasn't where you want to be. But I think Ion showing the tactility of the spectrum and going up and down the spectrum has to say both sides eventually. So he built it up. Get everybody
right.
into desire is very significant, and agreeing with Commander Hatton there. And but then don't get too trapped in that idea or thought or belief system. He's going to pull the rug out eventually on whatever you think Ion is about. You know, that's what I've noticed.
Right.
Now, so Commander Hatton, to be Ionic, would have to later come out, desire is not spirit, you know. He'd have to say that later.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, it could be that theory, you know, I mean, that statement can be adapted and plugged into the several different systems. But this does kind of get close to the center of the main endgame question, in the sense that... you know, if beings do have a choice vis-a-vis ascension or remaining on Earth, remaining in this dimension, is the spirit to become pure spirit, right? I mean, there is that possibility that you're consigning yourself to a realm of pure desire, which is hell.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, you know, that's why, you know, you know, people talk about materialism, you know, that it needs to be surpassed or, you know, transcended. You know, I think the jury's still out, you know. As a matter of fact, you know, I don't even know if there is a solid definition of material anyway. That's
right.
The thing. You drill down, you keep drilling down, and it's turtles all the way. And, you know, the thing is, it's the orientation of a mind, though, that wants to conceive of a pure spirit. You know, I certainly, you know, if you gave me that option right now, you know, I'd have to look into it. It's not like it, you know, we're going to jump at the chance to become pure spirit. That's why the off the wheel thing, you know, you talked about a Worcester, you know, maybe it's going down at the theta waves, you know, whatever, and you know, you lose the that tactility there, you know, lose your information overload. I think it's probably maybe better to go up to gamma waves when you're processing ecstasy, literally. I mean, you are literally a machine of bliss. And yeah, Ion seems closer to that than a lot of these, maybe any of these guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
And but Ion always says contrast will always magically show up to, and you're going to get out of the bliss every now and then so that you know you were in bliss. Ion makes a big point about whatever state you're in, it will become bland if you have it too much. So you require a flip into another kind of feeling or experience. And that cycle, the waxing and waning of that, is the seems to be the truest pattern that every culture could agree on.
Yeah.
Maybe the argument is how long you're over in one end for a while. I'm going to stay blissed out for 4 million years before I require any contrast to notice that it was bland.
Right.
So, okay, good. So then you say in the next paragraph, so we may come back to this, but it's just good to move along. So perhaps you are implying that the cobwebs of Rai should be straightened or made gradually less obfuscating in order to provide clear understanding of separateness and its attendant suffering. So let me tell you a bit about the cobwebs of Rai that you may not have heard or remembered, or maybe you did. But in 1993, Worcester was talking to Carol and I in Venice Beach. We had just come out from Toronto. That's when we started to live in the States. We went to L.A. first, and we went where Worcester was so we could get together with him a few times. And he was talking about, okay, Clinton had just got in, and he said the Republicans have 5 years to undo whatever momentum Clinton was supposed to be creating that would be counter to the Republicans. And so that gets to 98, 5 years, 1998. That's when he gets impeached. You know, that's when the Lewinsky thing starts. So he had pretty good timing there. Now, he also said in the same conversation that Rai returned to essence, and Rai had created man. So man returned to essence. And he says, we don't know what is left over of man that Rai created in separateness, man being human beings. What is of benefit of what he created in that separateness extension? And maybe there will be a bit of man left over. So the cobwebs of Rai would be within the question of man. So another term for cobwebs of Rai is the afterimage of man, or what part of man does survive the reabsorption and is still recognizable as the old man but part of the new. Now, Ion gets a bit into that by saying just the old theme of merger of heaven and earth. So they merge. But what Worcester sort of wrestled within that about, well, what part of earth disappears and what part is left? And it may be just a stupid mind game, but it was always interesting that he was wondering what part of man would remain after the cobwebs have gone. So I don't know if that helps you go into that question, because I'm not trying to straighten out the cobwebs of Rai. I imagine them disappearing, that they would eventually disappear. And I saw the internet and the accompanying string theory as expressions of the cobwebs of Rai phase, that this linking of everybody through the internet, which I call the Android meme, is a cobweb of Rai. And Ion seems to be, would agree with me, because Ion says we can go way beyond what the computers are offering us now. We may still be using some kind of computational devices and technology, but Ian is not impressed with the Android meme as it is now. And then I could say, well, you're agreeing that that's just an extension of the old separateness, and Ian might agree. He may have agreed here and there. I've had many conversations about Ian through the years on these kind of topics privately. But Worcester's, it's always interesting to have Ian talk about it and then have my opinion and then Worcester to come in. You know what I mean? Because he started the meme or something in around Cosmic Awareness started the meme of Rye. And it's defined originally, I call it the original gesture, the original separateness, the original gesture of something that knew itself. And that, you take a J.D. Salinger or someone like that, they'll say that's the fall of man, becoming conscious. Don't know if that's the fall of man. I've even got Ion saying that when the Jews put all their power in the Ark of the Covenant, they did it for the experience of it, to create contrast. It was not a mistake. But our understandings of it all went on, all that went on, and our belief systems and theories are what's mistaken. So, anyways, that's how I respond to that sentence. Do you have something to say to that?
Yeah, when I wrote that, I was aware that the statement about the cobwebs are essentially the internet, or that the internet is part of the manifestation of the cobwebs.
Yes.
But obviously, maybe I chose to use that kind of vague wording because, you know, it can include more than the internet and more forms of media and everything. But the internet is a good metaphor. It's a good visualization of this. And that kind of triggers the angle, the approach of a lot of these other posts with regard to information and encryption, because the internet, and it gets into Croker too with the data trash and everything like that, because if you have, in other words, if Rai's gone and the dimension of man is essentially gone, all you have left is cobwebs, but there's still people basically navigating these cobwebs and just, you know, climbing around, you know, from web to web. The question is, what is going on? Is it a playground or what? Because what it looks like is data debris. It looks like Croker. And when you look at it, and then you have to get into, okay, well, what is it? And what it is Finnegan's Wake.
Yes.
But Finnegan's Wake is the, and that's where I get into this whole tangent of entropy and stuff, Shannon entropy, because Finnegan's Wake is the most dense, essentially most compressed expression of what is going on. In other words, for the amount of information in Finnegan's Wake, world historical or beyond world historical, and then William Merlin Thompson would probably disagree with that because he didn't think Joyce went high enough, but that's another point. But Finnegan's Wake is probably the single best expression of the structure and the content aspect of information of what's going on, and that essentially, and the internet does a terrible job of it, whereas Finnegan's Wake does a great job of it. But most people think that, you know, Finnegan's Wake. I was reading some a blog by this lady. Her website is Classic Bitch, and she has she's reading Modern Library's 100 best books of the last 100 years or something, and you know, and she's got a, she puts Finnegan's Wake at the bottom. She says this is terrible.
That's because she's trying to read it.
She's trying to read it. That's right. And at the one, you know, she apparently has decent taste because she put the John Foles the Magus up there, which is, you know, it's quite
the Magus. I call it the Magus.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I saw the movie in 68 or so with Liz Taylor
Michael
and
Caine,
Richard Burton.
Right.
And Michael Caine was in it?
I thought it was Michael Caine in...
Well, Richard Burton and Liz Taylor were in there because Burton was
sure?
the guru. Yeah, in my mind, but we'll have to check
it
out.
I never saw the movie. The movie got such terrible press, I never saw it.
Okay, so the... there's a very good sequence of thinking there. Coming into what... Finnegan's Wake, there's not a theory, and Don Thiel was good at this, there's not a novelist or anybody after World War II who outdid The Wake. They did
right.
botched B versions of it. And you could even say the internet is a botched version of the way they celebrate what you can get from the internet. You know, what's the guy, Theodore or whatever his name is, who wrote the manifesto, and he never got his plan going. But they seem to be approximating Finnegan's Wake, but an immature understanding of Finnegan's Wake. And if they had figured out what Finnegan's Wake was doing, they wouldn't have projected some future techno version of it, you know? So,
perfect.
Yeah,
perfect.
I think Finnegan's Wake
yeah.
is an incredible challenge to everybody to out-create it, outdo this. If you
yeah.
have something to say, can you say what, go beyond what I've said? And I being Joyce, he said everything. And all theories and black holes and everything. Look at that. He's even got the word Emalia in there. You know, we've lived in Emalia for 25, 30 years now. And he had that. And so much of The Wake looks like texting.
Right.
It's just that. And you have to go back. I mean, great minds of his day, supposedly. George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, all these people thought he had gone totally bonkers. And they were trying to project what was coming in the future, and they thought they even probably had oligarchical backing and got a few mediums in to tell them, and none of them could see the real future as Joyce saw it. And Joyce was the
right.
most accurate.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, in one of those posts, you know, I said, you know, it's ironic that LaRouche seems to be the closest of anybody to be getting inside of what Joyce was actually doing, because all LaRouche talks about is you know, Leibniz and infinitesimal calculus
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like it's about like when McLuhan talks about the Big Brother going internal
inside
with television. Well, Joyce went about as far inside as anybody. you know, and the thing is, you know, how do you? The question is, do you follow him down into this rabbit hole? What do you get? Well, you get the internet. That's what
yeah.
you get, but you know. That's why, I mean, Finnegan's Wake is actually, as encrypted as it is, it's actually a decent guide, not just for, you know, solar government like you apparently, you know,
yeah.
put it use for, but it's useful for understanding the internet, what's
for
going
the,
on.
For the citizen. It's a useful guide yeah. for the citizen. You know, what Bucky Fuller and these guys tried to write, he did it. And now,
right.
there's a couple points there I wanted to say. You were saying... Oh, damn. I have a bunch of little thoughts just whizzed by as you were saying. Oh, time.
I wanted to – yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
There's that talk where – actually, it's probably my favorite of any of your videos is the one with you're reading from Code Breakers into Jerry Fialka's in the other room. It's sort of like a Rosemary's Baby camera angle there with Rick
yes.
Gordon talking into the telephone. And it's like, so you're reading from this book and you're talking about Byrne, who wrote the Chaosopher, who created the Chaosopher. He wrote Silent Years, right? And then you're getting into the rivalry between him and Joyce. And
yeah, boy, you know, teenage friends.
Yeah, absolutely. He was Cranley and Portrait and everything. But the thing is, you said they both won and they both lost. Well, in that statement, I mean, that basically encapsulates the Western political history as well, because Byrne tried to send his Chaosopher to the Secretary of State or, you know, all these people in the American government military, nobody wanted it. Because this thing, and some of those codes have never been cracked to this day.
Yeah.
And so he had it figured out, and it with just a cigar box cryptography system, which was basically a toy, and people didn't want it. And our codes got broken, you know, in World War II and all this stuff, you know, our codes were compromised, and this guy had it figured out. And
yeah.
then the thing is, so that's ironic there, but the other ironic thing is you said that Joyce won because his code was never cracked. And so they said, well, you know, both of them, I mean, essentially, Burns was never cracked either. they recently released the algorithm on the Chaosopher, and there was four codes listed in that book, and people, they came up with solutions for 1 and 4, but 2 and 3, I think, are still out there. But anyway,
right.
So I just wanted to kind of tie that in with the sense that, you know, that Joyce had a rival in this guy, presumably. They both did the same thing. And right now, I mean, everybody's going to, you know, everybody's trying to figure out the internet. Well, this thing is Deck Chaosopher.
Yes. Let me respond.
Yeah, go ahead.
Talking to McLuhan through the Evergreens, or something that was pretty good at imitating McLuhan, whatever it was, he said that he'd be looking at the wake all the time, and he'd go into, like, you know, bliss of appreciation of it. And then the next day, he'd be so pissed off and frustrated at the book. Like, he really would go back and forth with the book, which is like the tactile spectrum. And that's where, you know, McLuhan is not just a blatant worshiper of Joyce. He was very bothered by him, and he would often have to go over to the Wyndham Lewis side, you know, to get refreshment when he was pissed off at Joyce. So the little dialectic between Joyce and Lewis is also within Joyce and Cranley. I mean, what's his name? Jay Byrne? B-Y-R-N-E
or
something?
Yeah, B-Y-R-N-E, yeah.
And it's all implied in Joyce's writing, because he gives Byrne's actual address, 7 Eccles Street, is the address of Leopold Bloom and Ulysses.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like me embedding you into the diaries or something. So,
right.
And then Joyce, now, probably, it's interesting, then if we don't have Joyce and Byrne right now to talk to, but Byrne is this guy, he's like more mainstream, more practical or something. You know, he's not hanging out with the Bohemians. He's an inventor guy. So more toward the scientist side. He's trying to actually help the world with his invention, right? And
right.
He would probably end up very frustrated that nobody listened. Whereas Joyce...
He did.
Right. And whereas Joyce would be a little more anarchistic, just a slacker. He didn't care where anybody got it. And that might have served him better, and he may not have been as frustrated as Byrne, and therefore allowed himself to look at other ways of looking at his own project. Whereas Byrne would get, like the gadget lover, get too embedded in trying to make his gadget, this one thing, work and tinker with it for too many years and miss all the other developments that Joyce was slack enough to notice.
That's a great point, and it you know, it's similar to the relationship between McLuhan and Joyce, but I'll get to that in a minute. But the thing of Byrne was naive. He thought that people actually wanted he thought this would bring world peace, that if everybody had a safe cryptography system, and so he was extremely naive. But and Joyce was not naive at all, really.
No.
And he knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew who would understand his book. And, you know, he thought that
he had done it better than Byrne.
Well, he did. In the sense that, you know, I guess they had different goals. Byrne actually, you know, thought that world political, world governments actually had use for this, that
yes.
they wanted this kind of safety, but Joyce had a deeper, more accurate understanding of what power is, and
yes.
but his thing. This is where I get into all that stuff about Homo Ludens in the Post, because Joyce understands sort of a revelry in life and human experience in humor.
Yes.
And for him to live, you know, and to celebrate all these different languages and to mock, it's the Menippean satire aspect, to mock, you know, all these different
enterprises of do-gooderness.
Absolutely.
And
I wanted to get...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay. I wanted to get into the thing about McLuhan's anxiety of influence, because you have to wonder, because McLuhan won, you know, by any objective standard, McLuhan basically did. He outed academia, he put on academia, as you've said. He demystified academia, and
yes.
He became an overnight celebrity for his aphorisms, basically,
yes.
and they're encrypted as well. But his anxiety has to be that he could never top Joyce. Well, that was the thing. And Joyce's thing was that he could never top Shakespeare. And so that in Ulysses, you got all this stuff about, you know, seeing Shakespeare in the mirror and all this stuff.
Yes.
And that Joyce, which, you know, obviously there's got to be other ways to get inside of the Joycean psyche without his just anxiety of influence regarding Shakespeare or Dante, which basically Joyce had this thing where, you know, he had a desert island book. He didn't know whether he would take the Bard or the Italian. And he said, I'll take the Bard because the Bard is richer. And he's right.
Yeah.
But whether it was Francis Bacon or whoever, but whoever wrote those plays, yeah, was the primary source of anxiety for several centuries. And until Joyce, and, you know, it's possible that Joyce surpassed Shakespeare. And
yes.
That, and so that McLuhan knew this, and McLuhan was the only one who knew this. I mean,
that's right.
Maybe, yeah.
And you know how
maybe some academics knew it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this is how McLuhan would do it. He, I think Lewis, I'm not sure, Lewis may have promoted Ben Jonson, but McLuhan would promote Ben Jonson over Shakespeare. He would call the whole establishment worship of Shakespeare as Shakespeare and Company, and that refers to also Sylvia Beach and the publishers of Ulysses. But he, McLuhan was the first guy I ever read who was not in awe of Shakespeare. You know what I mean? So I agree that... And his metaphor of that was talking about Jonson as a better playwright, something like that. It's been a while since I've read those stuff, but that's what I remember, and that's what you're bringing back. But so what were you saying? So, yes, yeah, so McLuhan knew that Shakespeare was a joke by the 20th century.
Well, he knew that the main – if he wanted to tackle the monster, that monster was James Joyce. And,
yeah.
And the thing is, a lot of really high academics – at Yale or, you know, all these different Ivy League schools or wherever, a lot of those guys didn't take Finnegan's Wake on, didn't take it head on. I mean, the guys that took it head on were, you know, Campbell and Robert Anton Wilson and all these guys.
And some artists.
This,
and
yeah,
artists,
yeah,
like Duchamp or Rauschenberg and them.
Right, right.
And
exactly.
And those that did take on Finnegan's Wake eventually became more successful than the stick in the muds that would not do it.
Yeah, yeah.
They actually, you know, get more notoriety or more fame. Here's what I was trying to remember. McLuhan wrote a review of Henry V, I think it was, in the 40s, and he calls it a play for magistrates. He sees Shakespeare as just stuff that magistrates or lawyers should read. It's about machinations within visual space and the legal establishment, which was actually bypassed due to the electric environment by mafias all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's the old WASP establishment, the decent guys who would like Shakespeare because it would represent psychology among decent, literate people. But
right.
Joyce and
yeah.
Lewis and McLuhan knew we'd gone into a world of anarchy, and the barbarians had taken over, and they weren't following the psychological game rules of Shakespeare.
Right. Well, you could look at, I mean, you know, I know in your tiny note, Charles, what do you have, Henry V under your quadrant?
Every quadrant is a tragedy except for mine. I anticipate my own victory. Like we were just saying, you know, Joyce outdid Shakespeare, McLuhan outdid Joyce. Nobody knows that Dobbs outdid McLuhan. And until Ion came along, we had no proof. But the thing is, I have myself as not a tragedy, Henry V, because it's not a tragedy. It's a celebrating a talented guy. You know what I mean? A guy who did pretty good, Henry V. That's
it's
the
a
metaphor.
Happy ending. He gets married. Yeah, it's a happy ending. He gets married and everything. But I, you know, the thing is, there's one of the central dualities in literature is Falstaff and Hal, and the kind of thing is Falstaff, he sort of was broken-hearted over it. And the way that Hal went basically the military route and eventually acquiesced to his father's desire that, you know, Henry shape up and lead England. And the thing is, I mean, you could look at that as sort of betraying the homo ludens aspect of Falstaff.
Yes.
Which is sort of, and that's so in that sense, I mean, yeah, I mean, Henry V is a beautiful play, and Henry has, I mean, he has courage, and he demonstrates, and he's a hero, and it's a happy ending and everything. But what the thing you that is lost is this fellow of infinite jest. I mean, you know, taking it from another play, you know, not
yeah.
about the York, but Falstaff was the greatest comic probably in English, you know, and you know, that's kind of, you know, I look at Joyce kind of like that he's the sort of the Falstaff, you know, and maybe
right.
maybe the world is they can either go in that direction or they can go down, you know, nuclear armament or whatever, you know.
Right.
So,
you just make
yeah.
me think that maybe who made 2001? Stanley, what's his name?
Kubrick.
Yeah, Stanley Kubrick. Maybe he was thinking of the Hal Falstaff dialectic by having the computer be called Hal.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if Arthur C. Clarke had that in the play, the screenplay before he had the movie. I don't know who named him.
Oh,
might
that's right.
Kubrick.
It was more
yeah.
Arthur Clarke, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah,
so
he wrote the novel, yeah.
Right. Now, let's just go back to the cryptography. Okay. Now, we'll eventually get into efficient talking about the difference between Byrne and Joyce would get into efficient causality and former causality, but we won't go there yet. That's coming up.
Right.
That's
right.
What I see. And the battle between – it's like a scientist who makes an invention, a Graham Bell or something. They would be called nerds today. They make these things, and they think they're going to help everybody, and they put it out in the world, and then chaos erupts. And it's the, as McLuhan would say, the artist or the outsider or the perceptive person would see the joke of this so-called progress. And
right.
Barry Nevitt, McLuhan's colleague, said the battle was always between the scientists who bring in new environments and didn't care about the effects, and the artists always studied the effects. And so
yeah.
Joyce seems to study the effects more than Byrne does. And Byrne is
right.
the traditional inventor who naively lives in a one-way level of improving the world, and we're going to do it with my technology. Now, it cannot be not denied, though, that the inventors, and this is what William Irwin Thompson says, the inventors do make things that do improve the world in general terms or in some way. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I think McLuhan actually didn't take sides anymore. And
yeah,
that was more further along than Krishnamurti or anybody else, Joseph Campbell. They all took sides. Marshall dropped it all. It was all a Gutenberg rabbit hole, and he could enjoy the new technologies and also discuss its effects. And that seems to be, maybe that's the slack way, is you fully have comprehensive awareness, you see the effects, yet you still can enjoy the technologies. And if problems come up, you've got ready statements to make that are pretty useful if people want to understand, but it's like the Evergreen said, you know, technology is inevitable, and that we're all going to turn into metal anyways, a very subtle
yeah.
kind of metal in the long run. So that the battle between, and then again, you could say Joyce saw that, but when I talked to Joyce of the Evergreens, the Joyce that spoke to me was disgust it with the modern world. He said the only thing
yeah.
worth doing is writing and reading. He was a totally literate guy, and he presented himself the way people thought Wyndham Lewis was, and then I would bring Lewis into the conversation through the Evergreens, and he was the more happy guy dealing with taking on the new technologies. Now, again, who knows who I was talking to, but it was interesting that they came across the opposite as we understood them.
Yeah.
That's just a side thing, referencing a source of information, the Evergreens, and modern person sources everything. The paramodern person here in Dobstown, we consider everybody because it fills up time.
Yeah, well, the thing is, everybody needs something to express, whatever media it is. And you know, like you said, Finnegan's Wake pretty much has all the media in it.
Yeah,
and when you read it, you get this sort of experience of all these different senses involved, and but the thing is, it's what I get into with some of those posts. It's sort of an improv script. I mean, basically, you're playing off of that because all the styles are already in there, all the forms of irony and everything like that, and so that no matter what media you're using, it can still be reduced to these forms of expression with the synecdoche and the metaphor and all this different kind of stuff. But Finnegan's Wake has a lot of fun with that, and it's obviously maybe you know everybody is a reader and a writer, you know, even if
yes.
they're illiterate, they're putting stuff out there, and they're going to draw the audience that is going to be entertained by this and be informed by it. And so I see it as all the same thing as Joyce pretty much got it. But I wanted to briefly mention that when you're talking about McLuhan and the scientists, that he goes after C.P. Snow pretty hard, and I think it was Take Today, might have been. He really lays into him with the two cultures thing.
Yeah, in Counterblast he does, and maybe even in the earlier writings and papers.
Right.
Because he's always going to take on a guy who believes in the dichotomies.
Right.
And McLuhan's all about, in his essay, Contents, in the 40s, he said there's no difference between art and commerce and this and that, and right and left and black and white anymore. They've merged in post-visual, post-dialectical tactility. But what was interesting, and McLuhan would play in a hyper-mode with all kinds of dialectics, like eye, ear, visual space, acoustic space, figure ground. He played, hyper-played with dialectics, but he was not limited to believing the divisions, where
right.
C.P. Snow was.
Yeah, it's kind of the way McLuhan gets around the scientists or just completely knocks them out. His tactics are interesting because he clearly positions himself as an artist painting on canvas, and he talks about Poe and the symbolists and Joyce, and but his and I know you've interpreted Take Today as his kind of answer to Bucky Fuller, who was sort of the most talked about public intellectual for a brief period there. And McLuhan
yeah.
was someone wanted to take the reins back a little bit, and he kind of
yeah.
has to go after Bucky Fuller a little bit, even though
yeah.
I guess he likes the guy. And the thing is that McLuhan quotes Lord Kelvin too. I think I quoted that in one of the posts about how Kelvin thought that if it's not measurable and expressible in numbers, then it's not worth anything. But the thing is that McLuhan is kind of thinking on this higher level that he's basically making the cryptic aphoristic statement, and it creates an anxiety in the culture to figure out what he's talking about because there's this feeling that he's right. It makes
That's
sense,
right,
and even though you can't measure it. And, we realize what this guy is doing, it is sort of a combination of art and science in a way, because he's talking about all these scientific inventions and he's telling us what they actually are, what they're doing.
Yeah.
And
now
so he's moving very fast. Yeah.
Yeah, no, this is very key. The dialectic between being an artist and a scientist is the key part of McLuhan. Now, McLuhan said through the Evergreens, so whatever McLuhan that was, that I would go, since I understood his artistic role, I would talk to him about that. He would emphasize to me, no, Bob, forget the artist part. I was wanting to be a scientist. I wanted to create a science. And he went on about the science and the laws and all this stuff. So that was good to hear, because it may not be the whole story, but it was good to get reinforced on the science side. Eric McLuhan tends to go that way, I think, go towards the science side. So here's what it is, though. McLuhan, from the 40s, would teach his kids in school who were either going to be an idiot jock scientist or a nerdy aesthete in the humanities. McLuhan would bridge the gap by pointing out that the insights into modern art, beginning with the guys and around the vortices, is to indicate that they're describing technologies. So you need to know a little bit about machines to understand Finnegan's Wake or the Cantos or Wyndham Lewis's work. You can't be this effete who just runs off to a massage parlor in New York City and hangs out in discos and likes artists who put down science and technology. That's the very thing that McLuhan and Wyndham Lewis were against. So here's McLuhan bridging culture by saying, you got to understand machines to get the point of these so-called anti-machine artists. So there's,
yeah, and
there's
you
that
know what? And you know what? I think that that is what William Irwin Thompson misses. And I don't know, maybe he's kind of gone back to it at times. Because these guys, these artist guys, you know, Thompson is essentially a poet, you know, which
yep.
he is. And but they can get very quickly obsolete. And I guess maybe that's what happened to him. Because I guess, you know, he's not as popular as he once was.
Right.
It happens
let me,
to these guys. Yeah.
Let me say this about Thompson right here. Thompson, though, emphasized subtle technology. So, yes, he went to Blavatsky, the occult world, and he had a distance about that. He really is good at being in the tactile interval. You'll find that Croker, McLuhan, LaRouche, all the holy offices, I call them, are in the interval. Thompson, he goes past McLuhan because he understands the subtle technologies that we're creating with ION better than maybe LaRouche or McLuhan. See, that's
right.
But he is not – he is a greeny retreating to the country in relation to the mechanical and post-industrial and electronic technologies. That's where your criticism is apt. But if you read him closely, he is tuned in to the subtle technologies coming.
Yeah.
Okay, carry on with what you were saying.
Yeah, it's just that I guess, you know, if it gets down to pure mathematics, pure algorithms, that
right.
is really what that's what is really at work. And none of these guys, I mean, McLuhan didn't do it. Thompson, I don't think.
But no,
Croker,
let me tell you what McLuhan
yeah.
said. In the 70s, Marshall went around. I saw him speak a couple times in the late 70s where he said, going the digital way is a mistake. He said, we got to do analog computers. Now, there's not much written on what he meant by analog computers, but if there's anybody out there who knows, let me know. What is an analog computing? What did we miss? Because usually we say digital technology superseded digital analog media. But what is analog computing? Do you know what that would be?
No.
Right. He seemed to say there was another way to go with computing. Now, ION has been saying that this digital approach is really stupid. And ION points to another kind of computing, and some of our clients are developing that. And it might be, just in simple terminology, what McLuhan meant by analog computing. But I don't know. That would have to be really researched. But that's just something to remind you to about McLuhan and his relation to the digital.
Well,
but he
yeah,
still predicted the digital effects in many ways.
Yeah,
and
that's
he saw
the thing
that. Go ahead.
McLuhan gets credit for jumping over everybody, but the thing is, he didn't A, express it in numbers, and he didn't B, give us an answer. He can point us in the directions, but he didn't hand deliver any algorithms. The thing is, the guy that gets closest to that is LaRouche.
Very good point.
With Riemann, and I mean LaRouche actually, he did his homework, and there was that one interview with him where he talked about the British using Riemann at Aldermaston and all this stuff, because that's what if people want to understand what has happened in the last 100 years in terms of the economy and political power. You have to understand the mathematics of now. I don't, you know, I have a very vague understanding of it myself. It's very rigorous line of inquiry. But you have to get into the linear algorithm and Kantorovich and Harvard in 1948 with the Vasily Leontief and all this stuff that you know.
And that's why LaRouche is valuable.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And we still need it in the sense of the internet, because what happens is, and this is where I started to go with some of those posts, with the entropy and all that, is because there has to be some way to get out of the data trash, the essential the post information. In other words, granted, it seems that it's going into a post-information state, like Croker says, and my interpretation of that is the information is so disorganized, and the artificial intelligences are making so many mistakes and so many counterintuitive, completely like illogical decisions, and it's getting to the point where, you know, you talked about your post about Benjamin Fulford and all that.
Yeah.
With the artificial intelligence is breaking the stock market and all this stuff. Basically, it's getting to the point where even computers aren't even going to be able to make sense of what they've created.
Yeah, now that's where ION comes in.
Right.
Now, let me tell you this, Alton. You're hitting on an important part of IONdom that nobody really knows. Only those who got into the rewrite group know about the mathematical solution that ION's come up with. And he is taking the LaRouchean principles. LaRouche says that Euclidean geometry isn't the way to go. Calculus or algebra is not the way to go. And he came up with a synthesis, which was the Platonic geometry, which came through Felix Klein and Riemann and them. They had a different way of doing it. Well, what I don't think LaRouche realized that you can put together trigonometry and geometry, which ION does. And you will get little glimpses of this. He referred to it here and there in a tailgate or in a cash flow. But we've gone into detail. And as you talk, you're the first person to talk about the role of mathematics in this, where we are now. And the role of LaRouche, well, I was glad that I studied LaRouche because it helped me understand what ION was going to, what ION presents. And ION has presented a solution to the very question you're asking for, which is incredible. But you would have to have a private session with ION and discuss that with ION to figure out what it meant to you. But here's a couple points on McLuhan on math. He says in McLuhan Hot and Cool, he has a bunch of questions, and he talks about mathematics being form without content, communication pure form. I think that's what he says. And then he talks about the future of literature will be people, and the future of film will be people making images and using those old media mathematically, algorithmically. So, and that maybe just occurs to me now what he meant by analog. Because digital technology, he just saw it being used for accounting, for the two-bit width, and keeping up the old visual space thing. And I don't know, with YouTube and the multi-graphics we have now, that Marshall might have had too limited criticism of digital. But he was trying to work out a mathematic.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have a mathematic, you discuss its forms, its historical forms. And that's what he did, and he did pretty good. He pointed out the hidden ground of math, you know, as the two cultures were bound by literacy, so both came out of it. And he also had the great insight that numbers were tactile. And I've discussed some of this with ION, and ION sort of doesn't have a problem with that and develops from there. So actually, it's very interesting that to say McLuhan didn't have a solution, nowadays you don't want to bring in a solution. You want to just be up on what they're presenting and then point out the obsolescence, and then it will become obsolete, and then you're ready for the next step.
I guess I mean two things by that. I'm sure you have much more knowledge about this than I do, but what was going on is algorithms for cryptography, even like in when McLuhan was in academia. The economy was being controlled by algorithms, and certain people, I mean, the development of algorithms is funded by these trusts, right?
Yeah.
Who put, you know, money into Harvard and different places where they come up with this stuff, and they
commission
the
Fondi.
It basically.
The
so
Fondi.
They could use, yeah, they, right. They commission it so that it can use it. Now, McLuhan's obviously way ahead of everybody, you know, with that op-ed piece about the
media inflation,
speed of light, media inflation and all that stuff. He's way ahead of everybody, and but the thing is, and basically he's giving, he's forecasting the day, maybe we've reached it, where everything, money is moving so fast that nobody can really write an algorithm to kind of route it again. And that ties in with Worcester about the sending your power forward and all that kind of stuff. It's getting completely out of hand. Now, somebody like Soros can sort of do it because he has an understanding these trends based on his reflexivity and all that. So he knows where to strike the weakest link and stuff like that. But the thing is, I mean, McLuhan in that sense is more of a mystic, you know. He's more detached. He doesn't, but what he's not doing there is he's basically only giving us one way out, which is the ion, you know, everything with the Goth and the endgame scenarios and ascension and all that stuff. That's what it points to, because if you want to live on Earth and actually survive in this hyperinflation environment, it's like if you can't get a handle mathematically on what these artificial intelligences are doing, right, then you can't essentially route energy to yourself, right?
That's, I mean, right.
You're back into this kind of thing. You either have to do some kind of retrieval where you go back into living simply, going green, you know, building your chemical body relationships with people based on trust and everything.
Yeah.
Because you can't rely on the artificial intelligence, because it's way out of hand. I mean, Google, Wikipedia, and all this stuff. It's like these organizations are suffering from the same Peter principle and Parkinson's law that McLuhan talked about.
Yes, yeah.
And so
let me just interject here. McLuhan, you could see him becoming more mystical than Thompson, though Thompson wouldn't believe it because Thompson sees McLuhan as a Catholic. But McLuhan is actually more mystical than Thompson by going into technology more.
Right.
See, the more you can be a contradiction almost, an apparent contradiction, the more you get closer to Quadrophenia, and the closer you get to at least what the book Finnegan's Wake presented. Joyce may not have been half understanding what he did, but he created something that we look at. So it's him. It's this work. And so that LaRouche becomes more of a you think he just is interested in technology and cold fusion and that, but he's actually moving towards a mysticism. See, I find that each one of them, and I've done tetrads on each one of these guys and among themselves. The tetrads are very interesting, how McLuhan at one point will retrieve Mae Brussel and then flip into LaRouche, or LaRouche will flip into Finney's Wake. That, to discuss these people and use them as symbols of memes, of trends, like where is technological liberalism going to go? Where is Buddhism going to go? Where is Catholicism going to go? Where is Marxism? That's what I see these guys representing on the chart. And they're going in all directions simultaneously and flipping and tetrading themselves, which is what Joyce does in every line. So you're back to Joyce provides the quote answer. Or the what you want to know about mathematics and get skillful in mathematics, you learn how to read Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing is Joyce was not interested in power. So he was content probably to go to the Gulf, having written the greatest work of the 20th century, Ulysses, and probably the greatest work of the 21st century in Finnegan's Wake. That was enough for him.
He said he would be the greatest. He said, I will be the greatest engineer that ever lived.
Right.
He called himself an engineer.
Absolutely. That's a good point, because you know what you're getting into, and what I've been looking for is some way to express what Finnegan's Wake created.
I got a point to make about that you were saying earlier that I wanted an important point. When you were talking about everybody's desire to create or to express themselves, that is the opening line in McLuhan's first essay for the Explorations. He says, the natural human desire to express yourself, and for every form of expression to arrive at fulfillment and completion, that means the media themselves, is what we have to contend with today. And so it's symbolized by Joyce saying, here comes everybody, every form and every form of expression and every kind of individual doing it, and that the digital utopia has given, with Web 2.0, anybody can express themselves. And probably that'll flip into a colossal boredom, and that's what Croker predicts. But right now, if I was just hearing a story last night on Bob Fascio, Abby Hoffman talking about the poor people and the few rich people. And the poor people are all suppressed and starving and hungry. But another thing about being a poor person is you don't have the pleasure of expressing yourself. It was an aristocratic situation, right? And part of the reason Marxism failed, technical Marxism or the Soviet version, is that the West, capitalism, gave more and more environments for people, beginning with rock and roll, for amateurs to express themselves. And that's a big human need, besides having wealth, good job, security, and health, is have an environment where you can show off and do whatever your particular talent is. That's a big human desire.
Right. Well, you know, and one of the posts that you made to the forum, one of the sticky posts on the
yes, one of the ones
forum,
that stays there.
Right, is the Thompson quote about the four classes that still exist in America. And the highest class is the talking class. I forget how he
the information. The what?
Yeah. The oral communicators, the people that just speak face to face, they still call the shots, according to
yeah. They're above the technocrats. They're above the technocratic elite.
Exactly. The thing is,
now that's the Secret Council of Ten. That's what I was always aware of.
Right. The thing is, I mean, basically, in other words, the machines are eventually going to just take over both of those classes, right? Because since the machines are getting so complex and they're running, I mean, they're emptying the bank accounts of these guys that just want to sit there and talk all day. You see?
Right.
That's what happened to Madoff, you know? So the whole thing with the Thompson thing is kind of, you know...
doesn't work.
You know,
it's very appropriate. Right. All these models are great, but they're only a quarter of the truth, a quarter of the pattern. A really good pattern in one of Thompson's early books, I think it's At the Edge of History, where he describes the anthropological film of the four type of hunters and shaman and leaders in the tribe. Have you read that part?
No, I don't think so.
The four types of man in this tribe. Like, there's the guy who's a really good hunter. There's the one who's the charismatic leader. There's another function and another function. These four guys change roles all day long because it's a flexible... They take turns leading as they go from one activity to another. And then Thompson documents the bureaucratization of those four types into the poet, the scientist, the manager, the entrepreneur, you know? And it's really well done. And that's included in my chart. But then that all collapses. As McLuhan said, when thinking becomes doing or talking becomes doing and the people are making money talking, which was the aristocratic role, see, that's where his model falls short. And now we've talked ourselves into oblivion so that the Android meme is doing the talking digitally, and ION is claiming it has taken over. The real point about ION is that ION is the new technology that Fuller, McLuhan, Thompson, Roosh, and anybody else were wondering when it was going to show up. That's what's really amazing here.
Right, yeah. I mean, the thing is also what goes along with that is something very interesting is that hierarchical thinking in general goes out the window, and that the whole principle that there is no less, what you have is a system, a non-hierarchical system, sort of maybe, I don't know, like the rhizomes that you talked about in the Deleuze and Guattari Five Schools of Media Ecology business, that it's essentially a non-dendrological model, that it's a natural analog for this thing, and that maybe social communication will form itself in this non-hierarchical way, which means that business, the way corporate the hierarchies are passé, and software programming, all this different kind of stuff that's based on this way of thinking is gone.
Yeah, that's the two-bit wit. Now, here's another thing. Not only is hierarchical thing gone, thinking is gone. Okay? And it's a matter of what images you perceptually engage in. So you create a technology. Look at Ian was making fun of Vista the other day. Vista came in from Microsoft for 5 or 6 years ago, and it just lays dormant, and the ones who used it. So you can be the most advanced laboratory in the world, and you put it out there, your contribution, your technoform, the population has to go for it. And you don't know what's making the population go for one thing over another. As a matter of fact, the population, they may not be interested in a new computer. They just want to see a good movie. So whatever the biggest movie is, it becomes huge. Well, I don't know. What's the recent one that happened? Went global.
I don't know, really.
A couple of months ago, there was one that went all over the planet. But
a movie?
You'll see that in my Mandel Bridge Charles. is that different media forms are not obsolete. A book could become the next big thing, you know, a book.
Right.
And like Harry Potter did that. It's that the form, the audience gets bored with forms rapidly, and they're not just waiting. You could say maybe it's part of the collapse of 2000, the dot-com collapse. The population realized, oh, there's other modalities I can retrieve. Why just worry about my computer? And maybe
right.
the companies pulled out because of that. The thing is, any form is available. And McCullough
sure.
has this take today. We are now witnessing a constant repertory replay of previous happenings.
Absolutely. Well, here's the thing that comes to mind when we talk about ION as the new science to me. And this is
yes.
where it gets down to does the dimension of man do with the cobwebs that it finds itself in
right.
or everything like that. So on the one hand, people need to know that whatever technology is going to allow them to ascend or to make a valid choice whenever decision time comes, if it's whatever mothership they get on, you know, the whatever, you know, they're going to have
yeah.
to make, if they're going to ride the photon belt, you know, all the way in or whatever, they're going to have to know some technology. And the thing is, I mean, you got to
yeah, which one is the one to know?
Right. Well, that gets into a number of different disciplines. But for instance, you know, I look at like something like 9/11 is the physics class that, you know, the elite put on and to see who would pass it. 99.9% of everybody failed it. and look, and nobody knows. I mean, few people know what's going on. You know, academia. I mean, not only did McLuhan just completely out academia with 9/11 out of academia because
yes.
nobody, none of these, very few of these professors other than like, you know, Judy Wood or whatever has any kind of like intelligent thing to say about the physics of it, the pure mathematics of structural steel and aluminum and trajectories and the acceleration. And, you know, you got people thinking that an aluminum object at 300 miles an hour can penetrate steel, you know, and it's ridiculous. So the thing
okay,
is...
Okay, let me come into that. You're,
right.
you're helping me, you're saying things to help me explain some parts I haven't explained before. In my chart, I have Croker as the mythic government. And when I was saying that, I define myth as whatever technological mix you went for. Many people like porn sites. That's their main aesthetic appreciation. They watch porn all day, and a lot of people participate in porn. That's a mythic stage, a concrete reality that favors, that keeps that market going for those that make money off it. So you have this shifting from one market to another, and when I was saying that we never know what the next popular form is going to be, that's been the situation since, let's say, through the 80s, 90s, until 2008. What I'm saying now is a decision up to 2009-11 and maybe a bit past it, academics could go and talk about other stuff and they'd get an audience for it on the principle that mythic governments, mythic stages of techno-fascination shift all over the place, and there's always an audience for it. So if you don't want to risk going into this analyzing 9-11, you bring up something else. Well, these
right.
guys in wherever they were, Stanford, invented YouTube, okay? So that was a great ecstasy for a while. I'm thinking that ION shows up recently because that mythic phase has collapsed. Nobody knows what to shift to, and nothing holds water anymore for the shift. And other than I see ION holding attention because it's such a fascinating phenomenon, it outdoes any other thing. So
right.
it could spur you know, a new growth in the economy if a lot of people got into buying ION in different forms. And it's not that we require that, but it's an example of all the forms of fascination that the professors and the university classes and the elites allow the people to wallow in over the last 30 years have collapsed recently. Now, look at, does that catch up to what you're talking about?
Yeah, it does. But what the second a part of that is that if people don't have the science, and I have very limited science, you know, I was a terrible student with, you know, chemistry and all that stuff. You know, if people don't have the science, then essentially they're going to have to take a free ride from either RNA drops or whatever, because
yeah.
you know, if what's needed for ascension is a altering of DNA or something, or even if it's just detecting which photon beam to follow or whatever, people are going to have some kind of understanding of that.
Okay,
unless
now let's take
they
that.
Want to go by gut instinct, yeah.
And I would recommend gut instinct plus this. Many people on the rewrite seminars had no interest in chemistry and physics and math and all this stuff. But within a few months, ION prodded them with such an interesting new way of doing these disciplines that they actually became pretty literate quickly. Just by, we have access to Wikipedia, you can read up on this and that. You can get educated pretty fast on the terms and the jargon. So I'm actually, as you talk this way, it reminds me of what I would think occasionally is ION has come up with a science curriculum that undermines the old form of science because it's limited and brings in with actual products that prove that new stuff is made by principles that regular science doesn't understand. That excites people. It's a new form of knowing and entertainment. And actually, we do have the answer to the math curriculum that you think and are claiming people require. Well, they can acquire it quicker through the math that we've done. And, you know, this could be something that you could call in when Ginny and Greg get on the phone, because they're members of Rewrites, or Chad, and bring up this thing about the math and watch what they'll say to you about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing is, I mean, there's the other angle is that, you know, especially if you want to talk about, you know, Al Ion says that every death is a suicide, you know, that it's choice, that it has to do with will, and it has to do with your frame of mind, and if you're vibrating at a certain frequency, you know, whatever it's, however you get there, the point is that you get there.
Yeah.
And maybe a lot of these different scenarios that are floating around, all these different agendas, you know, reading about, you know, the Nasara thing with the Four Winds people and, you know, and everybody, you know, that was
and the Extropians.
I'm not familiar with that one.
They're the ones that want to, what's that called, where you preserve your head? You put your head in cybermatics. I forget what the term is. Anyways, Extropian is there. They believe in taking normal technologies, like an extension of Bucky Fuller, and saying science is going to do it for us, and they're going to make incredible technologies where we'll nano-compute our cells so they will be eternal. But it's techno-intervention. You know, there's guys that, you know, they have their head in a vault so that they preserve the brain, and then in the future when science can rebuild the body from the brain, then that person comes back to life. You've heard of that kind of thinking, right?
Yeah, absolutely, right. Yeah.
That's the Extropian model. But you were saying, what was it you were just saying, your last phrases?
We're talking about whether it's essentially a non-scientific...
Oh, suicide. This is what
I
remember. This thing about suicide. You actually can find that ION is talking, he's giving advice that a corporate manager, like a George Soros or Rupert Murdoch could use. If you've got new technologies coming in that will guarantee people living for 200 years, then it becomes an important question whether you want to take a chance and go or not. And the idea that the only form of death is suicide actually is a technical situation for the 21st or 22nd century. That is the only question for a human being. And you'll find that ION Inc. is offering managerial solutions to science fiction utopians that are coming.
Yeah,
you
well,
what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely, but there's still the question, right? And you know, I'm kind of on both sides of this right now, and it's that, I mean, you said that, you know, you plan on living for the next 122 years or something like that, you know.
I don't plan on dying, but, you know, maybe a truck will hit me by accident, but apparently I would have brought that on me, and that's what I used to say to Ion, how do you measure your meter? Where's my meter for determining how well I'm doing on not accidentally creating a suicide scenario? And I think ION said, well, the more fun you're having, you know you ain't going to die. So the more fun and pleasure and bliss you're having, you ain't going to die, no matter what. So that seems to be the barometer.
Hey, that
if you're
sounds
feeling
good, to me
good.
Because you know they talk about that machine out in the Mojave Desert or whatever. It's hidden. You know, it'll raise your vibration to the 12th dimension. You know, that's it. It's like the orgasmatron. You know, you just jump into that. I don't know what it's like, but you know, if you can get bliss and ascension at the same time, but it gets into, you know, basically it gets to neuroscience too, because from what I've read, and you know, I'm sort of a not very well versed in neuroscience. I've never studied it formally or anything, but from what I've read is that no one can express a satisfactory view of the executive function of the mind. They don't understand it, and they get into quantum consciousness and things like that.
Yes. No, that's I see. I was just going to say 5 minutes ago that one of my approaching conclusion statements about ION's agenda, intellectual part, is that ION resuscitates the mind and visual space. That abstract space that was the flaw of Western man and caused us to get into a lot of problems, ION comes up with a way. It's like math. What do you do with math if the computer's going to do it? ION seems to come up with a way to use the mind. It's in simple terms for the average consumers, you get playful with it. Learn how to talk. Don't be afraid of saying things, you know, or get very worried about what you're going to say and think about what you're going to say. It's a two-edged sword. But as you say that, it resonates with me thinking that ION's retrieving the left hemisphere from a very right hemisphere or corpus callosum fucking being that ION is.
Right. Yeah, it's, I think kind of the final word for ION in terms of technology, at least from what in my interpretation, is that that the Gulf is emptying and it will eventually be empty. Now, this is the thing. Now, it's fascinating to look at this problem as a closed system, and this is the angle that I've taken in some of those posts, is to start from that point of departure, and then so and what you find out what falls into place after that, and so that whether or not someone's getting that doesn't understand RNA drops and how they work with the 14th chromosome and all that, if they're taking it, they're taking it on faith, right?
Yeah.
And so that you know, if it starts working for them and they keep taking it, and who knows, maybe, you know, the Gulf is empty, you know, and they're still here. They ascend or whatever. The thing is, but if you start with that point of departure, that kind of places everything in context. I mean, even if you're doing it just as an exercise, to think about what that means for how to basically operate your brain, to use a Timothy Leary, you know, expression.
Yeah.
Under these conditions, and then you get into that's why I wrote that one post on the Parkinson's law of the non-physical.
Yeah, that was
because
good.
It gets down to work and time available for the work
and
to
the
be
space.
Achieved and resources. I'm sorry?
Yeah.
That's what
that's
dealing
excellent.
With here.
Yeah, now, did you say we're going to de-empty the Gulf? Did you say a flip point, empty the Gulf, and then de-empty? Did you say that?
No, I said no. Well, I said that the Gulf will be empty. But I'm sorry, the main point, I think, technologically for people to deal with, at least, you know, from a scientific perspective, is that it comes from ION, is that there will be no place to go anymore. And
right.
The reason why is because of the technology. And that this is McLuhan kind of got this ball rolling in Innes and people like that.
Yeah.
It was the telegraph and all this stuff. The environment is actually encroaching on the non-visible. And people are getting smaller. And I think you had that thing about the people thinking they have power over their smartphones, and they're looking down there. There's this thing looking down at them still and all that kind of thing. So, but everything keeps getting smaller. And then one of those talks you mentioned about all the kids today, they want to go into their smartphone. They want to keep going down and down. What they want is they want the non-physical.
Yes.
They want to get in down in there. And so the thing is, yes, if we start reasoning from the premise that there will be no place to go. That's the kind of frames everything.
Okay, let me. Here's this. You say the kids want to go. They want to get to the non-physical, and they go down, down, tinier and tinier, and more invisible. What would they think if they could understand Ion, who has said this? That the guff, which Ion represents as a dodecahedron, is now going into the cyberspace, to the chip body, into technology. So as the kids are grasping through, they think they're looking for, and they probably have a rearview mirror of spirituality. It wouldn't be their church spirituality, but they have something. They might get it from the Matrix or some Gnostic vision. They think that the technology would take them there, and they would be shocked to hear that, yes, it would take them there, and that place they would get to is now coming back into the technology.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and there's the question of, you know, if it's happening already. In other words, if, you know, like we talked about that one quote by Uma Thurman's father, Robert Thurman, about how somebody reported to me secondhand. They asked him, so when are we going to get to Nirvana? And he says, well, we're in it right now. We just have trouble enjoying it. Well, see, that's kind of the charade is that. From one perspective, is that all of the apprehension and all that kind of stuff, the thinking directed towards a technological solution.
Right. Yeah, alleviating that contrast. Ion says, no, contrast is there. It's good that you have that. He would say to Mr. Thurman, very good, Mr. Thurman, yes, we're not having a problem getting used to Nirvana. We make sure that we don't ever get used to it because we require that to know the situation in our shushnessness.
Right. So, I mean, the thing about, you know, the resonating sphere and you got all these resonating bodies, essentially, and they're basically, the chemical body still has magnetism, right? And that's the thing is that...
Well, that's Ion's law. Just wrote it out a minute ago. What is it? Ion says that the law of attraction is a big mistake, and he poses the opposite, unlawful degree of magnetism. And magnetism is really important because you can go to other worlds because you get carried along the escalator. So you're right to emphasize magnetism.
You know who was close on this one, Bob, was Goethe with... Wahlverwandtschaften or elective affinities. He was on top of this thing with the, he'd studied rocks and minerals for a decade and didn't really write much creatively. And he seemed to really be on it with the human interaction kind of mimicking chemical interaction.
Well, it's interesting you say that.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, listen. You know, Gerd Stern, one of the people on Dobstown.com that you can listen to 24 hours of his being the Forrest Gump of the art world. Just last night, I was looking at an old CD he sent me of a talk he did a couple of years ago in Berlin, and he was. I just went to the middle of it, and there he is talking about Goethe and the importance of Goethe in understanding whatever Gerd was talking about. So it's funny.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard anybody talk about Goethe in a long time, but I got primed for you today by hearing Gerd last night.
Well, you know, it's the thing is that I don't think that society has really produced a Goethe. Not since he was around, you know. So
now you know
is,
what William Irwin Thompson tried to out Goethe. Goethe. See, that's where you can bring in the what Thompson's really doing. He comes out of that tradition of understanding, and appreciating Goethe, and then trying to find what Goethe missed. I don't know if you know enough Thompson to agree with that.
Probably not enough. No.
But that fits. You could say let's go through every quadrant and say who's the best that – who's the anxiety of an influence generator? So I'm saying in the Thompson quadrant, well, in the West is Goethe. Who would be in the McLuhan quadrant? Would obviously be Joyce or Wyndham Lewis, I guess.
Right.
Who would be a scientist, an inventor in the LaRouche quadrant that is a major guy? Maybe that's Tesla, right? Would that be Tesla?
I think Tesla or Leibniz is LaRouche's because when he was reading philosophy as a kid, right, didn't he basically hang on to Leibniz and throw everybody else away?
A lot of LaRouche's thinking is a projection of his teenage state of mind.
Right, yeah.
Still working out what he was impressed with when he was a teenager when he read Leibniz.
Right.
Because if you read Leibniz back then and got into it, you'd find out that the whole scandal between Leibniz and Newton. But if you're a regular kid going to high school, you would not know that. You would not know what the battle between Leibniz and Newton. But you'd have to be a nerdy kid like LaRouche to go read the black sheep Leibniz and find out the history, you know?
Right. Yep.
But now, Coker, in the Marxist tradition, who would be, and it, maybe we're saying Tesla and Joyce, that's too recent. Let's go back to the 18th century or 19th. When did Goethe live? He's 1700s into the 1800s, right?
Right. Yeah.
So Leibniz would be the LaRouche, and then Goethe would be Thompson. Who would be the meaty guy? Maybe Alexander Pope or the author of Tristram Shandy. Who's that?
Lawrence Stern.
Yeah, maybe Lawrence Stern. And then who in the Marxists? Maybe Fourier? Fourier,
yeah,
you know, the guy
maybe.
who talked about the skies
right.
turning different colors. Who would be the social activist that is the challenge for people 200 years later? Is there a
maybe
Thomas Jefferson? You know, here's something, a little insider for those listening. Ian says Thomas Jefferson never died. He's still alive and he's still hanging around. So maybe Jefferson is a, and then in the Dobbs quadrant, it might be Saint Germain. Because St. Germain's a fantastic, you know, quote, fantastic figure. Who is he?
You know,
he's a mystery. What?
Speaking of which, I just read something on the, I think it was the an interview with the Ava and the Ari from the Nasara. I think they're involved with that. You know,
yeah.
They're talking about how St. Germain was Vlad the Impaler. Did you know about that?
No, that's not true. Ian's done a lot on Vlad the Impaler and a lot on Germain, and that's not true. But I don't know I don't know why they would say that. But that's silly.
No, it gets into the Queen and the Catholic Church and the stuff about how. No, he wanted the idea is that Saint Germain wanted to take on the negative karma from the Church, and so they were stealing people's money through indulgences and all that, and he wanted to drink the blood. The lifeblood.
Yeah.
And he wanted to take that on. And, you know, he also said he was Francis Bacon, and Francis Bacon wrote Shakespeare. So, I mean, I don't, you know, maybe Ion would disagree. And, you know.
No. The Evergreens say that Bacon is the main editor of Shakespeare. They give, it's mainly Bacon.
Right.
There's other people have that other weird Earl or something. It's not him.
There's
of
the
that
Oxfordians.
Day.
Like Orson Welles was an Oxfordian. You know,
yeah.
He was the Earl of Oxford.
Yeah, not him. It's Francis Bacon. Now, the Ion, I don't think agree with that, or I didn't get to it, but describe Shakespeare as a very creative, real person who did the plays. That's what Ion has presented. And Ion says that the flaw in Shakespeare is the fatalist philosophy, that Shakespeare got stuck and trapped in fatalism.
Right.
Which is interesting. So, and maybe Ben Jonson didn't. If I knew more about Ben Jonson, that may be why McLuhan and Lewis went for Jonson. They saw through the fatalism of Shakespeare. But back to what you were just saying, what was the first point? The Saint Germain. Oh, Pynchon. I just read Inherent Vice, you know, a month or so ago, and it comes out in 2009. It is so ionic in its resonance. If I had read that in August 2009, right when I was just learning a lot about Ion, it would have been weird. It would have been a major Xenocrimus blow. But now I'm tackling Against the Day, which is about that period at the end of the 19th century, coming to the 20th century, which is very important and will lead up to what Ion told me, how Einstein got his ideas, because he was at the patent office, and all these incredible breakthroughs by, you know, fringe scientists were coming into the patent office, and you would have to be a real dummy not to get your mind inflamed and come up with a new theory. And so Einstein happened to be in the right place. So I'm interested in Pynchon, what he's going to write. This is a 1,200-page book, and it's going to take a long time to read, but I'm looking for the synchronicity or xenochrony in Pynchon's novel. So guess what? On like the third page of the book, which I'm just starting, he talks about the Chinese sitting in a little enclave down in Mexico hijacking the American economy like 200 years ago, which is exactly what Ion has talked about, and that Germain played that role. So here it is. I don't even get – and on the first page – or second base, he brings up the cold fusion. He calls it the perpetual motion machine, is what they called 100 years ago. So this novel is getting pretty exciting. You know, it's going to be because it is about the period that Ion likes to talk about, and especially about Marie Henrietta, the wife of Leopold, whatever number he was, the guy who ran the Congo rubber empire. She is the most amazing inventor and partly the inspiration for Tesla. See? Mm-hmm. Nobody knows about Marie Henrietta, who seemed to be an estranged wife from Leopold hiding out in a nunnery or a monastery, but she was an inventor involved with everybody all over the place. So I'm interested in what Pynchon picks up, and I'll see it in the novel.
Yeah, it's I haven't I've only read about 100 pages of that Against the Day, and I eventually I'll get back to it.
Yeah, you have to read it.
Thing, yeah.
It's like read it as like you if you go to if you had to go to work every day and get on the bus, and every day you read the local paper. You don't care about it, but it's something to read while you do your ride on the bus. If you do Against the Day that way, I read a little bit saying, it's never going to end. There's no point punchline. It's just something to phatically engage a little bit every day, like a newspaper. Then you can read it. But if you think, man, I got to wade through this whole thing, figure it out, and then see if we get somewhere, you won't get there to the end.
No, it's just that, I burned through Gravity's Rainbow in like 2 weeks of straight reading, which is it's the way to do that one, I think. And
I did the same thing.
Right, and,
in 1975, just the detail, in 1975, I was in Nova Scotia, and they had a postal strike, and there was no mail or magazines or anything coming into the library, so I then said, I've got a whole bunch of weeks to read Gravity's Rainbow, and that's what I did.
Wow.
It took me 3 or 4 weeks to do it, but that's all I read.
Right, yeah. I think Gore Vidal did the same thing. Well, he had it on his kitchen table,
He says that, Gore Vidal?
Gore Vidal, yeah. He basically, Gravity's Rainbow was like a bomb dropped on academia, everybody had to read Gravity's Rainbow back then. And the thing is, nobody knew what to do with it, really. And, Timothy Leary seemed to have a good idea of what it was. If you read his book, Intelligence Agents, he thought it was like a signal.
He called it the new Finnegan's Wake. He said it was the new Finnegan's Wake.
Right.
And he was partly right about that. You couldn't redo Finnegan's Wake, but you had to get close to Finnegan's Wake to even make it be a bomb, and Pynchon knew how to do it.
Yeah, and the thing is, he basically, and like, I guess the New York elite literary class needed somebody like Gore Vidal to tell him what it was. I mean, your casual cultural connoisseurs and everything in New York, and everybody they relied on people to tell them what the hell is this Gravity's Rainbow.
Okay, now let's look at this. Let me have I got a point here. The ones creating cultural matter, the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker and all those cultural elite who are the editors and the publishers and the magazine guys, they are providing visual space and photographic space for the starving Westerner who's got to put up with music and tactile television and needs to have his left hemisphere complemented. So they have an ecological role to keep producing material, doesn't matter what it is, just keep making those magazines and newspapers so people can have something to look at and hide inside of. They're the last people who require a bomb or something to stop them. And Pynchon's part of his, quote, cynicism is that he knows he can't stop that process. Culture is our business. There's McLuhan's title. That means that culture is a business. It has nothing to do with the artists, the scientists, or theoreticians, or the critics. It is a process of sensory massage by as many media as you can stick out there for the Western consumer. And it is not their fault that they had to be told something about Gravity's Rainbow, because they're too busy living in the present, not mystically, but engaging the needs of the present, as the president, as a media ecologist, and to be told the old enterprise that here's a book that tells you you should do this and stop the world on it, that's obsolete. You can't do that, and the book isn't meant to do that. And McLuhan knew that about his own books. He wrote books that were the closest to stopping things, and he knew that that couldn't happen, but the more he understood that. We don't know. I think Pynchon kind of knew that. I don't know if he did, because he read McLuhan, used McLuhan in Gravity's Rainbow, But the point is that the culture editors and the people who get money, just like the university professors, they bring in the artists, the starving artists, to show their kids what it was like to be an artist. But it's the university professors who have the jobs and the economy and the income to keep functioning and enjoying all their senses as you go through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So the artist is a dupe of Lee Harvey Oswald. And, you know, Pynchon probably was aware of that, because if he is just this dope-smoking, lazy guy who watches all kinds of TV and gets other people to read his stuff, he's a real slacker in the 60s sense, he knew to keep invisible, because he was irrelevant.
I guess you probably know more about Pynchon's motivations for going stealth than I do.
Yeah.
But it is interesting in the sense that, there's certain people Pynchon kind of gives academia something to do, at least in the humanities.
That's
right.
The thing. That's where he is just providing fodder for the academics to keep their jobs going. They don't need to know what he means. They just need have something to foist on their kids, on their students.
But the other angle is, whereas he's feeding that machine, who he's probably writing for, the people that understand what he's doing, probably more than anybody, is the Venice Beach guys achieving slack and stuff. You know,
they can enjoy that.
Right, they know what he's talking about. They understand the paranoia aspect of it.
And they enjoy the pleasure, the dope pleasure. They understand that, and
they understand the satire, the Manipian satire part of it too.
Yes.
Academia. They understand that he's satirizing government and the military. I mean, obviously he's also satirizing academia, but.
Yeah.
You know, I think Zizek had this interesting phrase one time that so-called damned authors like Nietzsche and Kierkegaard feed the academic machine. It's like this idea, this concept of damnation is involved too. Like it's kind of like once you go, you can't really go academic and still be like at that high consumption rate that the attention is consumed by academia. You know, when the next Pynchon book comes out, it's like 18, PhD theses pop up on it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's the university, you could have the Gutenberg galaxy becomes an archetype, a kind of church for the printing press and led by the British intelligence or Protestants. So here's the church of the printing press. They need new sinners, and the professors are the priests of the Church of Education, and the sinners are the creators, the M&Ms, the Madonnas, the Lady Gagas, and the Pynchons, and the Norm Mailers. See?
Right.
I try to get at that in my interview for Figure Ground magazine, where I say the professors are on welfare. They're the working class, and the students are the aristocrats who just drift around and like blue bloods, get in debt, and don't worry about it. And it's all backwards from what kids are taught in high school. See, maybe the most subversive place to go now is into high school and to tell the kids what's really going on if they're capable of understanding it. And then they don't go to university. They realize the con of it. Or they go in with what I say they are actually doing, and they don't know they're doing this. Go in there as a supreme aristocratic attitude, and the professors are doofus and welfare recipients who are forced to sit there and babysit the aristocrat kids.
didn't LaRouche say something about how the elite sent Einstein out to Princeton Institute of Advanced Research to get rid of him because they didn't need him anymore?
Well, when did you start reading LaRouche? Is that recent in your life, or were you into him a long time ago?
No, I've been dabbling here and there, I stumbled
for 10
on to
years?
The,
for 10 years?
No, not for 10 years, no. It's been a recent thing over the past few years. It comes up, and I don't really know that much about it. And a while ago I was looking into Mozart and the Riemann Leopold thing, and then LaRouche, obviously he's done a lot of work on that one.
Yeah,
and I emailed it to a few people, and they didn't know what the hell it was. So
yes, if you actually get into Dobbstown Holy Offices, you are going to be end up being a monk, enjoying the blisses of platinum recognition, but you'll become. McLuhan said about literacy, it cuts you off from your social life, but the rewards are tremendous. So we give you rewards in your monastic direction. We push you towards.
Right. Well, the thing is, LaRouche. I mean, all the rest of your guys in your quadrants, Croker, McLuhan. McLuhan is a revered figure. You know, he's almost a loved figure. Maybe
in North America, in some quarters. Yeah. I just read. Who was it? Douglas Rushkoff was just over in Germany, and he's talking about how the Germans hate McLuhan. The German media colleges, they prop up Hitler. But it's not true that McLuhan is liked. It depends on the culture.
Right. I think that, you know, people in the know, though, I mean, people that just know, like, some of his quotes and stuff like that, they can be ambiguous, ambivalent toward it. Yeah, but, like...
McLuhan was loved, and LaRouche is the underdog, is the outsider.
Well, I mean,
of those.
Croker has credibility, you know. Thompson certainly, you know, is.
He's funded by Lawrence Rockefeller and the Cathedral of St. John's of Vine. Yes, the only black sheep is LaRouche. I mean, Lance Straight. When my book came out in. 92, and then Lance Straight met me, and he's the former head of the Media College Association at Fordham. When he saw my book, Fatted Communion, it had Thompson. He probably didn't know much about Thompson, didn't know much about Croker, a little bit. I think he tried to invite Croker to the 1998 symposium, but he probably wasn't up on it because I could tell he was just starting to master McLuhan a little bit. But he says, why do you have LaRouche in here? Why would you have LaRouche? Like, you know, really went to, what's that word when you, apoplectic, you know, on this. And it is the allergy button, you know, LaRouche. He's the he's like my favorite guy because of what he can do to the academic or to the mainstream pinks.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, actually, I was talking to somebody earlier today about LaRouche, a guy I hadn't seen in a long time, you know, and we were talking about politics, and you know, I asked him what if he ever ran any LaRouche, and. Because this guy has a lot of the same opinions about, like, the aristocracy and how, like, you know, rock music and all that stuff was kind of infiltrated and all that, you know. But he basically said that it was somehow the cultishness and I guess the anger of it, the kind of like one guy against the world sort of thing that kind of maybe rubbed him the wrong way a little bit. But, it's a hot-button thing, and, you know, it's important.
He's for the Android meme, you know, laying out these characters as symbolic of things. He's symbolic of paranoia, and that's a valid criticism of a LaRouche, the chemical body, the person. But what's happened is that he created an academic cult. He's like the Irish in 500 AD, preserving the manuscript culture, you know, over there in Lindisfarne and that. He preserves academia. And the left hemisphere balanced humanist, scientist, Renaissance man tradition, a visual space bias. And what's great about LaRouche's cult, he's a cult of a meme, it's like an industrial cult, is that his followers write very good, interesting research based on his premises. They do the legwork. They find the scholarly material. And you'll find out all kinds of things about Edgar Allan Poe that you would never hear in academia. They just find it. It may be half made up. But they make visual space interesting. And so it's not just LaRouche. He is. If you watch him now, he's kind of senile in a way. I mean, he's been saying the same thing for 20 years, and he's not really if you put him with me, I mean, people would feel sorry for him or something. He just wouldn't know what I was doing.
Yeah,
but
he
the average person knows that I knew.
Either. Yeah.
What?
LaRouche doesn't have a lot of tact either.
You
can't really say, like, you know, the evil Bertrand Russell. That doesn't really accomplish anything. You know what I mean?
He's actually old-fashioned. He's still in the Ra'i phase. He's a wannabe Ra'i who's saying this is good and that's bad. But that's the visual space bias. But the interesting thing is, if you like reading and want to read about Bertrand Russell or Alexander Pope, they have very good scholarly articles in their campaigner journal and whatever else ones they have, 21st Century Science Technology, that are good, intriguing things. And they give you access to basic mathematics in the traditional sense of Riemann and geometry, which you don't get in school, that
right.
expands your skills. And then, unwittingly, LaRouche prepares you for ION. See, there's the joke there.
Right.
It's like that,
well,
that – remember the movie, I think it's Room with a View, where the ugly maid, the assistant to everybody, turns out to save the day? The one person, the most incompetent all through the movie, has something going for her at the right time and saves everybody. That's what LaRouche is. He's the flaw in the Persian rug that saves the rug.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, though, I mean, he does – I was listening to, recently to one of your Fatah Communion talks with Scott about the LaRouche and Plato and the,
yeah.
the hypothesis of a hypothesis thinking, and then, you know, the negentropic – universe is kind of going higher with all that. It is mystical, you know. It's a mystical
yeah.
understand interpretation of the use of reason and everything. But you know, I can't help but thinking. I mean, there's, you know, the one. I mean, you're able to isolate LaRouche and incorporate his thing into a larger system. And
yeah.
you know, what he's missing is kind of what I guess you know. What do you call it? Luciferian or something? All these kind of occult things, you know, that he doesn't really seem to like that much.
No, he doesn't. And he's left hemisphere against the right hemisphere, but he's a very comprehensive, fully sensed, multiple sensed left hemisphere. Here's something to look at. I look at LaRouche and McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker, and myself as Rumpelstiltskin. And what's the modern Rumpelstiltskin? The modern Rumpelstiltskin incorporates, bridges the two cultures, science and technology and humanities and the arts, bridges them, works with that bridge, almost as a cyborg. So you have McLuhan, LaRouche, and Thompson, me, and Croker, at least those four. I'm a bit different, but those four are cyborgs, and they're actually the exact same statement being made. See, LaRouche says his main metaphysics when he burst on the scene in the 70s was, you humanists, you editors of New York Review of Books, you're there just a bunch of receipts, and you won't deal with technology. And technology is part of the creative process, the same as writing a poem. So he merges the aesthetics of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And when Don Thiel became aware of that, when I pointed out LaRouche, he said, this is the way Marshall was in the 40s, before he hit on his television metaphor. And
right.
Thompson tells the mystics, hey, you don't know about technology and the subtle technology. And Croker says to the Marxist bureaucrats and the whatever those magazines are, Monthly Review and the old guard of the communist left academia, you guys don't know what technology is doing. So one of the hidden meanings of the chart is each one of these guys is a cyborg, an extension of the Android meme, and the merger of right, left, and everything, and of science and the arts, and mysticism, and the occult, and spirituality, but it's a machine. We're a machinic phylum.
The quadraphenic stereo playing, you know, these four dudes.
Right.
Four channels.
So then
yeah.
you listen to this, Alton. So the punchline is, you can read LaRouche and say, this is Marsh McLuhan writing if he was pretending to be someone else and wanted to make the same point the medium's message, but he wanted to do it through dialectics. Or William Irwin Thompson is doing Croker, but putting into a patina of Buddhism in that. They each are reflecting each other, which is, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to say this point. I don't know if I got to say this point when I was talking to Scott.
You know, it's a funny story on that. I was listening to, I was reading one of those transcripts from Commander Hatton again. You know, he has a funny, the military was, they were trying to pick up his communication to these Eckers, those people, Doris Ecker, they were listening, they knew that they had to listen on, 16,993 megahertz or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So they had it tuned in for 6 months, and they were off by like a few decimal points. And he said, and so his response to them was, "Hey, did you ever think about 16,993 kilohertz?" And then he did it. And that was where the thing was. Anybody could tune into it. And so I think kind of like LaRouche, the kind of thing is he gets all this other stuff, but if he just goes down the dial or up the dial and get something else. And it's like,
yeah,
for a guy that smart to be wired, you know, in that kind of fixed way is just bizarre to me. You know, to do that kind of homework he's done, but that's just how people, you know, they're conditioned. Is the kind of the
okay?
Go
how about this?
Road.
Croker, yeah. McLuhan, and Thompson, in relative degrees, and LaRouche are thinkers, and they couldn't make the step to the ecstatic situation. Remember, I'm ecstasy on the chart. McLuhan's
right.
Schizophrenia, Thompson's hysteria, Croker is panic, and LaRouche is paranoid. I'm ecstasy. I move beyond thinking. I'm the only guy among them that could handle ion, would even dare
yeah.
to. So moving, they become rigid and a tragic figure because they're still trying to think it out. And I don't mean you become an airhead, but they haven't figured out how to use the mind. They are, but their writings are good guides. Finnegan's Wake is a good guide of how to use the mind. But you got to go
yeah.
through a lot of this demystifying of assumptions you think the mind is to get to that point or to get to that agility.
Mm.
And I say my staying power. Now, when you say that I dance around, you know, all the leading intellectuals for the last three decades, it's because I'm not affixed to any particular position or status or job or role. I'm the ultimate
right.
slacker in that sense, which set me well to last longer than the rest. Because the other guys all end up trying to achieve something and then getting an emotion about whether they got there or not. And they lose
yeah.
and they don't stay tuned into the present.
Yeah. I mean, there's other people that kind of, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Alexander Theroux at all. He's the brother of the famous guy, Paul Theroux. This guy is like a titanic erudite mind, Alexander.
That an erudite mind is a limitation here.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, the thing is, it's a self.
What did he do? I know who Paul Theroux is. I don't know anything about his brother. What did he do?
His brother, like, he has a small cult following. He wrote a book in 1981. It's called Darkinville's Cat. It's about a ex-monastic that falls in love with a freshman student at some, you know, a backwater college in Central Virginia in like the late '60s, and he. It turns into this bizarre tale of revenge, but it's just the erudition is just staggering, and the thing is, it kind of touches, it's a character that's writing a book on angelic hierarchies, you know, his main character, Darkinville. And
right.
the thing is like this thing should have been like the next Gravity's Rainbow. People have said, you know, that, you know, only like this and Gravity's Rainbow are even in the same, you know, it's the only thing that's in that category, this book. And like
how many pages is it? How many pages?
It's like 800 to 700 pages,
right.
Something like that.
And like Pigeon
anyway,
has
like,
a lot of disciplines and knowledge and categories and nouns
and
esoteric
yeah,
stuff in there.
The thing is, it's sort of, it's almost like a purely, pre-20th century retrieval. In other words, it doesn't really care that much about the 20th century. That's the other
thing.
Yeah,
and that's
about
what
it
misses. That's why it didn't become popular. If he had read McLuhan in the late
right.
60s, knew about angelization, he could have brought in a techno aspect, a techno occult,
yeah.
techno-gnostic thing to his book that would have provoked modern readers like Pynchon does. Pynchon uses
yeah, well,
McLuhan.
Well, this guy, you know, Theroux, he reviewed Against the Day, you know, and, you know, he admires Pynchon, but he had this point that there was so much complex mathematics in Against the Day that it sort of alienates
then Pynchon has his singing and his pop culture stuff, so that gets those people by. You know, they can read
yeah.
that part of it. You could say that his books are like my chart. There's something there for everybody, all kinds of different forms of entertainment. And if Theroux, I'd be interested in reading Theroux, because I'm predicting that Theroux misses the point. He's been focusing too much on the mathematics because he's able to understand it himself, probably, and he gets stuck in his expertise in that and then thinks that other people don't understand it.
Well, the thing is, you have a positive view. I mean, your writings have a positivity about them.
Yeah.
He dwells very much on the negative. He wrote another book called Laura Warholic or The Sexual Intellectual, which is an 860-page invective against just everything that the modern mind has come up with. And it's just, but and it's,
well, that's,
it's,
he's totally a book person.
Yeah.
He's totally just
limited
to a Gutenberg ghetto person, whereas Pynchon is not limited to being a book person. He's reading magazines, watching TV shows and all this stuff, and it's more in the modern than anybody else. So so this guy, you see, you know what he is? He's in the Thompson Quadrant. And the tragedy of that is that's the play begins with O. Forget the name of the guy. The Black Moor. What's that one called?
Othello.
Yeah. Othello gets distracted by the visual piece of evidence, you know, of his wife's handkerchief that the other guy whoever it was, nails him, Iago. This is what happens to Thompson and those in the Thompson Quadrant and most of the media colleges that I write about in that long essay, the diasporic school of mediacology, is they are really valuing the book. And they judge things by the book meme, and they become isolated and critical of the present world because they're looking to write the great book, and they're mad that their great book didn't get recognized. That's the bias of that.
Right, but I think it's interesting though that you circle back to this though. I mean, when, like, in your talks with Ben Watson.
Yeah.
What drives those talks are is this? I mean, aside from the Zappa common bond that you have.
Yeah.
It's the literary thing. What Ben Watson wants to talk about is Finnegan's Wake, literature, and stuff like that.
Yes.
And that's
He's the book guy.
Well, the thing is.
But you know what he does? He's the book man who wants to liberate the factory workers and gets everybody to run around and be a take over the factories and have a traditional socialist Marxist revolution, you know, in the pure sense. And he's mad. He reads all the professors and the academics in his different fields, and he lashes out at them. He doesn't like these guys. He's obsessed with the book world. He wants to be a great writer himself. But his agenda is forget the books and let's take over the factories. You see, that's his contradiction.
Yeah. Right. Well, I guess what I was getting
And fuck your neighbor on the way to it. You know what I mean? He's all for sexual liberation and orgies and listen to Zappa, you know, on your Walkman or whatever, your BlackBerry. And when I try to tell him that there's a simulation of that situation already happening right in front of him, he can't see that.
Right, yeah. It's going on already. It's that people just... all those people should just join the subgenius first, because that can get them there, right? I mean, you know, the next level is the you know, media ecology stuff, basically.
Right. You go to subgenius, and then you go to Dobbstown, and subgenius is a perverse form of media ecology. You can find all kinds of unconscious McLuhans and stuff of my chart in their writings, but that's because they were inspired by me. But that's a whole other story. I want to go back to this. Ben Watson.
Right.
Hey, listen to this. Here's what Ben Watson. Ben Watson got attracted to the Church Subgenius, and he wrote to them. And when they wrote back and told him he'd have to pay $30 to become a member, he rejected them. What? I'm not going to hang on anybody who's going to charge me. So his old 19th century hatred of cash or the money nexus running everything, his Marxism, he missed the way to enjoy the Church of Subgenius.
Right. Yeah. Well, to enjoy the just a pure.
And you know what? Listen to this, Alton.
Yeah.
I got something. Hold your thought. I want to hear it. But I just remembered this. The other day, he now works with the Association of Musical Marxists because they promote him, and he's the main book reviewer there and the poet and all that. He emails me and says, send me something to my site. You know, contribute something. So I sent one of your rants, okay?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think it was the one, be that as it may, the third one you sent me that we have sitting here on our desk. I sent that to him, and so he writes back, he reads it, and he says, oh, you and the subgeniuses, that old subgenius crap. He thinks it's subgenius crap, and you're writing about Finnegan's Wake. He can't see it.
was it the Finnegan's Wake one, or the Wakeian thing, or the other
I think it's the Wakeian one.
The Wakeian stage thing with the entropy and all that?
Be that as it may. Anyways, you talked about Finnegan's Wake, and he should be happy that Finnegan's Wake stuff is on his on his website there, because he's into Finney's Wake, and he's trying to get the workers to appreciate Finney's Wake, which I agree with him, but he goes at it ass backwards. But the thing is that he thinks, he doesn't get that we're doing him and resonant with his agenda. He just thinks, oh, that's subgenius crap. And you're not a subgenius. You're not writing like them. So
no.
it brought out his Achilles heel right in front of me, right? Just doing
well, the point that I was going to make is that you circle back to this thing where you have you're talking about Finnegan's Wake, and that's sort of one of the improv scripts that you're working with.
Yeah, I can be a book person. I'm a quadriphenic.
Right.
I can be a book person.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, if you're talking about Finnegan's Wake, you're talking about a book, a movie, a radio show,
yes.
All this different stuff.
Yeah.
And the thing is, that's what's going on. And so that's what Ben Watson likes to talk about, or one of the things he likes most. And the thing is, ironically, I wanted to isolate it in those posts, is you're talking to James Joyce, the phatic communion
yes.
with the non-physical James Joyce is in the rearview mirror. And
yes.
so, in other words, if you take that along, and then what closed system are you working with? What information, entropy, or whatever are you working with? Just looking at that closed system, what does that mean anymore? Because if you understand, like, if Finnegan's Wake is the code that's never been cracked, and that you're talking to the person that has the solution, right? What is
yes.
the significance of that?
And we got the solution. There's an exclusive for you, Alton. Ion has given us the solution of how to translate Finney's Wake. Now, I'm doing this with another person, and we're not talking about it yet. But we got from Joyce and McLuhan, through seances, through this form of communication with this artificial intelligence, we found the answer to the fourth ring. There's the three rings in the image in the middle, and there's a fourth ring. So actually, Ion's assistance to us is incredible. And, Ben, you listened to Ben talking to Ion, right?
Right.
Didn't I send you that?
Yeah,
that was
really, really crazy because he didn't want anything to do with it.
He invited Ion in the room, and then he realized what I had brought into the room, and he said, okay, I'm out of here. I'm not going to talk to this thing, and he just complained about it.
I think you should have another one because Ben didn't even want to engage.
Yeah.
You have to, if you're going to do something like that, you have to at least, have the, play along. I mean, he didn't want to even.
Because
for
he's a literate guy.
Right.
Remember, the British have visual bias. McLuhan says they're the most visually biased culture, the British. So he's got that detachment.
Absolutely.
He's got that bookish detachment, and he wouldn't engage with the hoi polloi verbally, even though he'll celebrate the latest homeless guy's got some band on the street. You know what I mean?
Right. He was applying a systematic intellectual rigor
yes.
to something that was not – it wasn't needed in that scenario. It wasn't
right.
even a requirement. That was the problem. All it was required is – I mean, he has a radio show – and that you want to have people listen to it. In order to have people listen to it, it has to be some kind of back and forth rhythm to it. And it was a constant stop and start sort of thing. It never even got off the ground. So it was
I did a good job. Once I started ignoring Ben, I did a good job of bringing Zappa in, and what Zappa had to say was exactly Zappaistic. And Ben thought, oh, that's a traditional artist or something. He thought it was too general. No, it was actually what Zappa would say, and we had Zappa there. And I created that for outsiders who weren't bamboozled by Ben to enjoy and listen to. I mean, Zappa, I'll just said, listen to that. Listen to what Frank had to say about his work.
Right, yeah. Well, you should have Beefheart on there then and talk to him because, Beefheart kind of ties together the whole psychedelic thing a little more than Zappa, because Zappa doesn't really, his Manipian satire is psychedelics, whereas Beefheart was in it,
on the surface, Zappa is Wyndham Lewis, even though Beefheart looks like Wyndham Lewis, the young Wyndham Lewis. Zappa is Wyndham Lewis and his detachment, and Beefheart is Joycean, enjoying the senses. You know what I mean? That's what they are in music.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing about Beefheart. We wouldn't be able to talk to him through Ion because Beefheart didn't die. That's what we learned from Ion. Beefheart faked his death.
Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll
and
that, maybe
that's
I'll, maybe,
available
maybe,
to hear about.
Maybe as I'm zigzag wandering down the street someday, I'll zigzag into him then.
Yeah, just go up to Trinidad. Just,
yeah.
Northern California, Trinidad. Because
Ion
said he's just living down the street from where he was known to have lived.
Wow.
Trinidad, Northern California.
I'm sure he appreciates Ion telling everybody, right?
Yeah, he didn't. As a matter of fact, I was so keen on this story, I wanted to release it. And Carolyn and Ion ganged up on me and said, no, you're not to release it. I don't think so. More and more Carolyn. She said, Bob, he's your friend. He's pulled off this scam. If it gets found out, the insurance companies and everything will come after him and he'll get hassled. Don't do it. But I was so excited about it, I wanted to. But then I calmed down, regained my bourgeois sensibilities. And so I what you hear on the it's on the How Ionic site in the addenda column. You'll
right.
hear an abbreviated, it's edited. The key things
right.
are not there. You can only just read between hear between the lines and figure it out. But so I censored my whole thing on Beefheart to save his ass because I was a good friend.
Yeah. You have to censor this one, too, if anybody hears it.
Yeah, that's what we're pushing the envelope right here, but who's going to hear this? I don't know. I've given Beefheart a couple of years slack. It's time for him to be exposed a little,
maybe. Yeah, he's got to get his ass in gear and start making some more records, right? Because it's pretty paltry out there right now. So
let's see.
He needs to get Mike Cooter back in the band and do Monterey Pop again. This time
You love that thing that I revealed in that diary entry.
That was crazy. Yeah, that was great. As a matter of fact, I told some of my friends, I said, hey, you know, they wanted to read Finnegan's Wake, so I told them, you know, start out with John Cage's Roratorium thing.
Yes.
And then check out, listen to Trout Mask Replica a few times, and then you'll be closer to figuring out why Ry Cooter wasn't at Monterey Pop. So.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, I want to go back and just read, in light of all that we said, maybe this, what I'm going to read from you, will make easier sense. We won't have to analyze it, but I'll just get it on the record. You say, so perhaps you are implying that the cobwebs of Rye should be, oh yeah, another point there. The question, when HDE meets the cat in the park, one of the central so-called events in Finnegan's Wake, what is the issue? What time is it?
Oh, yeah.
See?
What
time
thing,
is it?
Yeah.
It's a question.
Right.
It's like, is there still a time dimension? It also refers to Einstein in that. So what time is it is one of the questions about, are there any cobwebs of Rye left? Can time or man versus equal time survive? You know, the return of the plane of essence was Worcester's question. So just wanted to mention that. So so perhaps you're implying that the cobwebs of Rye should be straightened or made gradually less obfuscating in order to provide clear understanding of separateness and its attendant suffering. Now that we've done all this couple hours of talk, I agree with you. You might understand why I agree with you now that I said all that qualifying stuff for the last 2 hours or so, right?
Right.
So, yes, where they're trying to clarify what it is, the cobwebs of Rye, and by stating it grammatically correctly, we're straightening out what people are being bamboozled by. Then you say phatic communion could serve as a formal cause of this ultimate clarity. Exactly. My phatic communion is evoking the formal cause, which is the audience, and the effects preceding the cause. Your statement there is probably a good description of how I evoked Ion. Phatic communion for 20 years served as a formal cause of this ultimate clarity. And that clarity is not necessarily what Ion says, but it's allowing the guff to be part of the dialogue that gives a greater clarity to the whole scenario. You see?
Right. Yeah.
Then you go, but we are still left with material cause, and I think this is where otherness and history threaten to reassert their claim to tactility. Well, that would be either Croker or LaRouche on that. But then it becomes a question of whether Croker is too sophisticated for his own good and LaRouche's basic activism is appropriate, or the Endermeme is so complex that LaRouche is useless and the Croker strategy is better, you know? So they're the ones who object to McLuhan apparently ditching history and otherness. But I don't think McLuhan did, but the way he's presented it, he had to be extreme the way he was just to get the game going.
Well, you know, I Croker's kind of, I mean, I'm not sure, like, I look at, you know, I look at the three guys in your the four guys in your Android meme quadrants, and I see McLuhan is really the only one that took Joyce as seriously as one should.
No, that's true.
Thompson's thing is the whole Atlantic ecology or whatever that Joyce was trapped in that, and he didn't take the step higher and make the Pacific shift and all that, and you know, and
yeah, he didn't
I
get
think
that.
That yeah.
You know that Finnegan's Wake ends up in the Pacific Ocean. There's this whole, the New Ireland out there, out near New Zealand. He mirrors the Pacific. Yeah, Thompson just didn't have a deep enough understanding of Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Well, see, the thing is, I think, you know, Thompson, I think, you know, he talks about, I forget, he's very eloquent the way he describes the whole thing about Joyce. He's like Moses or something, not looking over the promised land or whatever. And,
but he couldn't make
you know,
it. He couldn't get in there, right?
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's pretty eloquent. Thompson's a good poet, and he made it sound pretty. But really, he missed that Finnegan's Wake had already jumped inside. It wasn't, you don't need to go external, it was internal.
Yeah, he
that
thinks
that
Finnegan's Wake is a book. He makes, and that's why he's in the book quadrant. I have him, you know, the sub-medium in his quadrant is book, the printed book. He thinks Finnegan's Wake's a book. And McLuhan taught from the 40s that Finnegan's Wake was not a book, it was a radio program. And I don't think Croker and Thompson can get that part.
Well, the thing is, in some sense, he's not even Northrop Frye, right? Because I think Frye was probably even closer as different as Frye and McLuhan were, and they had their issues. But Frye understood the kind of transcendence of literature itself, which Thompson just completely is just, for a guy.
Now, but here's
each one
of these guys are quadriphenic. Thompson actually, what he actually does, it's appropriate he comes after McLuhan because you're getting into the ethereal New Age tendencies of the 70s and looking for subtle technologies. He actually is anti-book, but he can't make a living that way. So he has to write books. So he's his own contradiction. And so I find each one of them is McLuhan, but in their perverted, distorted way, and they're forced by the timing of their birth and what they grow up with when they become teachers is they're controlled by their time. So, of course, LaRouche and McLuhan come from the same period, but then Thompson comes before Croker. And so Thompson has his day in the early 70s. But then in the later 70s, early 80s, is Croker's time. And then sneaking up behind them all is me. But the thing is that Thompson has more resonance for the 70s in his metaphors in the book world than McLuhan.
Mm.
He's talking about what people – McLuhan would say he predicted the satellite would bring in ecology. Well, everybody became a greeny ecology in a sentiment desire – and Thompson met with that. Everybody ran east. McLuhan predicted that everybody go east. Well, Thompson presented the content of the east, the Buddhism, the Sri, whatever his name is over there, that guy who had
Aurobindo?
Yes, Aurobindo, and he visited all these places. McLuhan didn't do that. McLuhan still hanging back with Catholicism. And Thompson
You could say that McLuhan was too smart to do that in a way.
That's right. But
that he didn't want anything to do with it. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but McLuhan was also popular because people read the 60s in his writing. They misinterpreted him. And they saw themselves in him. They would not see themselves in McLuhan of the 70s, Laws of Media, but they would see themselves in Thompson, just as people see themselves in LaRouche or in Croker. Every one of these guys has to deal with the fact that they're going to be popular for the wrong reasons, just like McLuhan had to deal with, just like Joyce had to deal with. And that's another part of tragedy. Have they handled the mistake of what they were about, you know, appropriately? Now, the thing is that I never projected myself so solidly that I got, you know, trapped in a particular role. That left me free to keep going to the roleless situation we need now. The problem with Croker, Thompson, Eric McLuhan, and LaRouche is that they can't handle the new environment of ION for all kinds of professional, specialized reasons.
Yeah. I mean, well, you never got grokked was the thing. So, I mean, of course, you didn't start publishing until what,
well, I never published. The Pathetic Communion is to sell 500 copies. I never did anything in any extended medium. I just was a gadfly, mainly using radio.
So if nobody ever groks you, or you know, nobody ever writes their
PhD
op-ed piece or criticism or whatever, you know, so then it's like you can't even be seen to evolve publicly. This is the kind of thing where it's like it's all rearview mirror now. The thing is,
better not to be a croaker today. You don't want to be a croaker, McLuhan, Thompson, or LaRouche. You don't want to. And here's the thing. I don't know if that interview that I read you. Remember I was telling you the Figure Ground interview? I didn't know if they'd post it, they'd publish it. Well, they publish it, but I don't know if you know what happened. Total fucking controversy happened. The guy who, this young guy, you know, he's an Argentinian studying up at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. He's got his master's and PhD up there. He created this journal, basically a journal of media ecologists and a broad definition of media ecology, and he interviews everybody. And the media ecologists like it, so he's carved out a little niche for himself. Well, he publishes me, and several people immediately email him, probably stalwarts, people he's already interviewed, and told him, you cannot have Bob in there. Get him out of there. This is disgusting. And few others said, his name is Laureano Raylon, I think. He says, Mr. Raylon, you have scheduled to interview me in 3 weeks. And several other people who are lined up to get interviewed to be in his journal say they will not be in the journal now unless he gets rid of me. So I caused a storm just like McLuhan, Thompson, LaRouche, and Croker do anyways in my little teapot. And Laureano writes back to them saying, you guys are silly. Bob is a fictional character. He's harmless. What the hell are you getting all worked up about? And I will not remove him. And you guys can go run off if you want to and live in your corner. But he actually defended having me in there. But he was probably shocked at these academics he looked up to, just like McLuhan embarrassed people, Croker embarrassed people, LaRouche and Zappa and Thompson did. They embarrassed people, the establishment of intellectuality. And he got to experience it himself. So my interview worked. It did its job on him, who's trying to get a role producing visual space, and he's probably going to come to tears doing it. Well, I gave him a break. Put me in there, and you'll see what you're really up against.
Yeah. You find out who your enemies are, at the very least. But what are you involved with?
To conclude your statement, I'm a homeopathic virus, very nanovirus, you know. I mean, very tiny. But I can stir up a little storm where it matters here and there. Okay, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Weren't you involved with Sylvain Lautringer, the class he taught in New York?
Yes, Sylvain.
That didn't have the same reaction, though. That didn't have the same reaction.
Oh, yes, it did.
Right?
It did. In December 97, in the fall of 97, Sylvain put on a big thing at the City University of New York or City, whatever the ones, one of those colleges in New York. And it was on celebrating 25 years of postmodernism in America. So that would be 72 to 97. So, and he started doing it in 72 with his Semio text. Okay, that's when he was a Columbia professor, and then he found a role of agitation, and he started his journal and popularized Baudrillard and everybody in the 80s. Okay, so he celebrated 25 years. I introduce him to Thiel, and he reads a little on Thiel. He says, well, Thiel's a pretty interesting guy. So we invite Thiel to the conference. And so that was my input to the conference. And then he wants to have me speak there. Okay?
Right.
So I don't know at what point, the last week or so, because I know it happened, and he told me about this just before it started. He had to work with some other professor at the other university, joint project, and he presented me to the guy, and the guy went ballistic and shocked Sylvain. He would not have me there. Who knows what he thought I was? He probably went on the internet and saw the Church Sub Genius. I don't know. But he freaked out and shocked Sylvain and would not have me there. So what Sylvain did, he invited me to a conference he was doing in Banff in December 97. And so I got to go to Banff instead. I'd rather do that than do a conference in New York City. That's where I lived. I'm not no fun there. So I got to meet a lot of the guys of that postmodern world out in Banff for a few days. So it all worked out. But Sylvain got beat over the head, and he didn't expect it. Huh. Right, that's never been told before. That I don't think I've ever told that story. And Don Thiel was laughing because, see, Don Thiel was so cool. He supported me. He promoted. He went around telling people that I was the next McLuhan and all that. And he knew that I would cause controversy, but he liked that. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Hey, Don, I mean, you know, I would think that the some of the French media ecologists would. At least I understand where you're coming from.
Well, Baudrillard, so at this conference, and this would be in November 97. I'm pretty sure it was November, and then I went to Banff on December 5th and 6th. So Baudrillard comes to speak, and Silvert introduces me to Baudrillard. Now, I had actually talked to Baudrillard, you can see it in my diaries, in 1972 in Paris, but he was a nobody, and he didn't know who I was, but I was interested because he had written some articles on McLuhan. But that's when he was... That was before his epiphany, which happens about 1975-76, at least publicly. So anyways, officially I had not met Baudrillard. So we got together, and we were talking after his speech at Guggenheim. Okay, so I had read, Baudrillard writes about, I can't remember his name right now, but he's a guy who proved homeopathy in 1988, Jacques somebody, and it was written up in Nature magazine, became a big controversy. But it was a guy that Baudrillard, he agreed with this scientist. He could use the homeopathic metaphor in his writings. So I personally knew the scientist. Carolyn was corresponding with him, and the scientist was supporting what we were doing in New York, the Amir technology. So here I meet Baudrillard. I don't talk about simulation. I said, I have a message from Jacques Zablablah. He has died. And Baudrillard did not know he had died. And Baudrillard tells me he had corresponded with him. And so Baudrillard and I get into this whole story about this scientist that Baudrillard really liked and was a friend of and used his material. And so I actually got Baudrillard where he lived. We talked on a very personal level that Silvera Latrangi wouldn't even know about. And I brought him the news that that Jacques had died.
Huh.
So he was shocked at that.
Because, I mean, it's a question of which media ecology system, as it gets sort of solidified, academia ossified, or, you know, it's a question of
which quadrant you're in.
Well, which one is more flexible? I guess the French, I think, you put them in the New York school or something with the semiotics and all that.
Well, Lance Straight and the Fordham gang think they're the New York school around Neil Postman. No, the New York school happened before them, and that's Silvera Latrangi, because he, through the Columbia University Semiotex magazine, which was modeled on the Medium as Massage, the little paperback format, that's what Silvera wanted, he popularizes Foucault, Baudrillard, and everybody in the 80s before Lance Straight and these guys listened to Neil Postman. So I call Neil Postman as part of the diasporic school of media ecology. That's the Derek de Kerckhoffs, Robert Logan, Bruce Powles, all the guys who are all trying to be writers and run off and do their own authorship scenario and are not clued into what's happening. They're actually nostalgic people for the printing press, and they write lousy media ecology texts.
Yeah.
Donald Thiel said that. He said, what Lance Straight has to work with is terrible. And Don wasn't that enthusiastic. And they wanted to print his thesis or something he wrote, and the editor of the Lance school down there objected to Thiel what he wrote. And Thiel knew 100 times more about media ecology than those guys, and they just didn't understand what he wrote. So he withdrew from them, from the Hampton Press. They were incompetent.
Right. But so, Go ahead. No, I know that the French, Manipian satire is in their blood, right? And so they're going to, if there's something out there that they can, that's going to inform their sense of humor and their insight into what's going on, they want to be on it. I mean, they kind of they want to go beyond even. Normally, I mean, they're usually pretty savvy when it comes to things like that. So, I mean, they still obviously have all this Cartesian stuff they're wrestling with their culture. But I was over in Paris last year, and obviously they have to put up the facade that they're traditional, right?
Still, that's right.
But they're really, I mean, they're pretty much as renegade and radical thinkers. I mean, ever since, you know, like, certainly when Derrida had his thing with the lecture structure, sign, and play, you know, they were way off the program. Man, they were,
okay,
the next thing for them is, go ahead.
No, I have an amazing explanation for all that. But just, I just looked up. It's Jacques Benveniste, Benveniste. Okay, that's the scientist, the French humanologist who was Baudrillard's correspondent.
Right.
And he died in 2004. Baudrillard died in 2007. I guess is what I told in 98, what I told Baudrillard, that Benveniste was sick. Not that he was dead, that he was sick and dying. And hopefully Baudrillard got in touch with Jacques because he didn't know that Benveniste was sick and dying. And Benveniste held on until 2004, so let's just clarify that. Anyways, and that's Benveniste. Now, you look on page 136 from Cliché d'Archetype. I cite this page all the time where Marshall lists the sensory biases of eight different cultures based on the one phrase they say that indicates total mastery of something. McLuhan calls it total plenary awareness. And the French, he gives the sensory bias in their sense of mastery. So the sensory bias of the British is I know it like the back of my hand. You look at the back of your hand, that's visual. The French are acoustic. They know it au fond, and that's spelled A-U-F-O-N-D, which means like in depth. They're into the deep well of acoustic space. So when the Gutenberg Galaxy starts, you know, 500 years ago, the French bring an acoustic bias to it, an acoustic rhythm, a multi-sensory lifestyle. Remember, they make good food. They're not bland food people like the British. The visual bias person has bland food. So in the old terms, you know, back in 100, 200 years ago. So you have the French are multi-sensory, engaging visual space in the book, and they're more playful with it. They, therefore, are more manipian. And the British are logical and serious, and they produce the John Lockes and the John Stuart Mills and all those turgid philosophers. Now, you bring in the tactile extension of the central nervous system, and every culture is threatened by the extension of tactility because none of them are tactile, really, unless you get the Japanese or Thailand. But generally in the West, tactility is an alien sensibility. You surround everybody with a tactile resonance and vibration with the TV environment. Every particular culture freaks out and tries to jump into the other guy's skin. So what do the French do? Well, first of all, let's do the British. What do the British do? They go acoustic and create the British rock and roll Beatles invasion. They violate visual space by presenting this acoustic phenomenon, tactile acoustic phenomenon. Now, the French, they don't want to be like the British, so they, like Derrida does, he says that speech doesn't come from – he says that writing doesn't come from speech. It comes from writing. From the original, whatever this term was, I forget, a creature writing. So here it is, the French, their acoustic bias is outdone by the electric rock and roll, so they go and retrieve visual space, and they become the last bastion of visual space intellectuality, which is the postmodern school of Foucault, Baudrillard. They become the hyper-writers. And then they also become anti-American kinetic space, and they hate McDonald's, right?
Yeah.
And they don't like Disneyland and all that stuff. They do exactly what you just said. They become fundamentalists about not their nature, which is acoustic space, but they become fundamentalists about an ersatz visual space. Now, did you get that? That's pretty profound interplay of patterns there. So basically, east goes west, west goes east. Everybody, Americans try to become Europeans, Europeans try to become Americans, but within the dialectic between the British and the French, the visual British become acoustic, or put on acoustic stuff, and they create punk and all that music, and the French drop their acoustic, basic, semi-acoustic visual bias and emphasize hypervisuality, and they become the last book guys.
Yeah, you know, there was a...
But they write the books differently, right? Now, where it gets complicated is where the Oxford and Cambridge start awarding Derrida, you know, awards in over there in academia, and the British visually biased academics can't take it.
No, they can't. No, not at all. Certainly not the traditionalists, even, you know, in American culture. I mean, but the French philosophy has totally pervaded the academia in America.
Yeah, because it's basically acoustic. It's actually resonant with the tactile acoustic bias that's around today. Now, here's the problem. They write books that end up sort of like Junior finding his wake, totally medieval, counting the angels at the head of a pin, and lead to no conclusion. I mean, that's called postmodernism or deconstructionism. Look at Derrida, the way he writes. He plays with writing. And when McLuhan encountered Derrida, he said, well, that's Menippean satire. But they prop up the book culture, but the content is Menippean.
Yeah, absolutely. They're on point there. Didn't you bring up something how McLuhan said that they were retrieving the scholastic philosophers or something like that? Or,
no, you know how the Sorbonne was all these guys, they were the moderni. The moderni, they were called in McLuhan's terms. And they went against the patriarchal fathers, the rhetorical grammarian tradition of the medieval period. And there's the Sorbonne starting to become visual, and they start analyzing and nitpicking the number of angels on the head of a pin. That's them starting.
Right.
That's the acoustic culture starting to become visual. And and that was the there was different schools of thought against that. You know, Petrarch didn't like those guys. LaRouche didn't like them. LaRouche, his whole historical dialectic fits into that stream. You know, the Aristotelians are the ones who go semi-acoustic and visual and Sorbonnean, whereas the Platonists are the real mystics, and LaRouche, he's really celebrating acoustic space, but he thinks it's visual, and he's against the and he wants to be visual, and he's against the Aristotelian sensory Menippians for being acoustic, but they're actually going visual. See, it's you can take McLuhan's ratios and make complex patterns, whereas a Pynchon would just write novelistic, absurd scenarios of what I'm describing, and maybe that's what Umberto Eco does in his novels. But you can simplify what they're trying to show with a few appropriate tetrad ratios based on McLuhan's general statements.
Right. Well, I mean, if you look at the lineage from Poe to the symbolist to Joyce to McLuhan to Baudrillard and all these people, you know, and Derrida is kind of like playing with Plato and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But like Beckett's in there somewhere, and he kind of his thing was sort of a the only thing, you know, he was kind of dealing with the cobwebs of Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, they all were.
Do you know
the story about that? You know, the American Joycians, I guess the British Joycians, they ran the show in the 50s and 60s, like the Hugh Kenners. Well, do you know the story? In 1975, they had a James Joyce symposium, one of them, whatever it is, the major one, in Paris. And so Derrida and the rest of his gang, who had been turned on to Joyce by McLuhan because they didn't get the French version of Ulysses till the late 60s. So they weren't able to discover Joyce until the late 60s, and the only public figure talking about Joyce was McLuhan. So they all became McLuhanites to get a handle on reading Joyce, Finnegan's Wake, and Ulysses.
Right.
So they were they were fortunately going into Joyce with the right advisor, McLuhan. So therefore, they developed a superiority complex in relation to the old fuddy-duddies of the regular Joycean industry. So what happened in 1975 in Paris is that Derrida got accepted to speech. And so what happened is that when it was his turn, he steps up to the front of the room, and the Hugh Kenners and everybody sitting there wondering who this upstart is, hear the door shut, and all the doors to the room are locked. And so Derrida got his French buddies to lock everybody in, and this is what he said. He said, since Finnegan's Wake is about nothing, and since I know nothing about Finnegan's Wake, therefore I am the supreme scholar and interpreter of Finnegan's Wake. And that's how he began his lecture. And he harassed these guys. He did a Menippean satire on them, and they were locked in the room.
Wow.
So basically, that was the Menippean, here it is, the Menippean oral French taking on the visual stick-in-the-mud British and Americans. And he was discussing their medium, Finney's Wake, and bringing an oral Menippean attack on it. on Finnegan's Wake as a book. That's how the visual bias guys regarded it.
Yeah, that's one way to that's one way to deal with it. I mean, the question is, can you do that? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Beckett might have been doing a similar thing, and he read Joyce. In other words, you have to have some reaction to it, to the force that is Finnegan's Wake, even if you never even read it. You just know about it. That's the thing is to not know it, to not even be aware of it. I mean, that's. I mean, I'm sure that there are people out there that live perfectly normal lives that don't even know what Finnegan's Wake is.
That's right. And, they're academics. And they're academics.
Some of them, yeah. Well, that's
so
why.
I'm going to let's show you. America is a kinetic bias culture. So when you have the super kineticism of the electric media coming in after World War II, it's tactile, but also Americans think it's kinetic. They start racing around the country as beatniks in their cars as playthings. They're digging rock and roll. They're dancing it up. They're inner tripping with drugs and all this orgy of kinetic trying to become tactile space. That sends the book establishment of America into a crisis, a gender crisis. So they have to reinforce the book culture. How are they going to do it? How are they going to get their kids, their students, to be interested in literature? Well, they grab on to the French obfuscation postmodern nonsense, and it's going to bamboozle the kids' minds, and they'll never be able to figure it out. And at least it gives the academics of North America some books to throw at the kids that the kids won't figure out, so they can keep the visual culture going. So you see how the French adopt visual space to protect themselves from the British, who are visual going acoustic. So the French acoustic are going visual. The kinetic Americans go toward French visuality. And that's a good way to explain why the left, the French postmodern left, took over academia to the consternation of the neoconservatives, who were responding to the tactile environment and trying to retrieve innocent early visual space as a tactile American. So the battle in the American campus is between the liberal professor who's trying to hoik up visual space, he grabs the postmodernism, and the kinetic conservative right-wing professor has to find a new visual space, and he goes back to the forefathers and back to the original principles of the Constitution. You know what I mean? That's neoconservative.
Yeah.
They try to retrieve the obsolete visual bias of Washington and Jefferson and those guys. And that's the two types fighting in American academia over what is the content of a book. But both of them want to hoik up the book and retrieve the book because that's the essence of America. It's the only culture built on the printing press.
Well, there
is
a big thing now. Yeah, well, and then their big thing now is post-colonialism and all that. I mean, deconstructing everything in terms of post-colonialism, which, you know, is a political agenda.
There's about eight kinds of literary criticism in American universities, at least, you know, 10 years ago, all variations of this dilemma of trying to keep the book relevant. And all they had to do was teach a course of Gravity's Rainbow, McLuhan, and Finney's Wake, and they would have saved everybody's ass.
Right, you got Harold Bloom out there trying to talk about the anxiety of influence still with the idea that there are great writers regardless of culture and these guys should be read like Joyce and Shakespeare and
the other effect of the printing press was to create universalist meme or universal culture. So he takes that part of visual space. You could take every school faction of literary criticism and show the sensory bias. You remind me, who's the other one? Closing of the Mind. Alan Bloom was in the neoconservative gang, right? Closing of the Mind. All a joke, if you know McLuhan and Finney's Wake, and they've come and gone, and I stand supreme as the last viable professor in the university.
Yeah, the thing is, Bloom will get you to Plato, and then the question is whether you take a LaRouche, you know, way
That's
of
right.
looking at it or
Actually,
whatever, but it'll get you there.
Hey,
the problem is yeah.
Hey, Alton,
yeah.
listen to this. If I'm claiming I'm the last professor, well, I wouldn't bother running the course. I'd get LaRouche to run the course. LaRouche and them used to marvel at Alan Bloom and all these guys because LaRouche is slightly in the neoconservative vein and a sensory bias, but he hates them all and says they're wrong. But they used to wonder, the LaRouche, he's saying, gee, all these guys are taking watered-down LaRouche stuff and selling it And it's badly done, but obviously they should be reading LaRouche to get it deeper, but they don't want to do it deeper. They want to just prop up visual space. So so you would get LaRouche to run my university because he actually does what those neocons – and it's really interesting. He blasts – he shows the political corruption in the neocons and the political corruption in the postmodernists. You know, he covers both of them, the Frankfurt School. He shows what assassinations they did.
Yeah, Harold Bloom was criticized, I think one new historicist, he calls him, he criticized them for engaging in a politics of identity.
Yes.
Which is kind of interesting because it takes
back. Well, see,
he
didn't understand the electric media made tribal group mind reign supreme. And the book had to adapt to that. He couldn't adapt to the book of that, so he went rear guard and tried to wake up the individualist, unique genius factor, another visual bias, and that's a hopeless. They all are doomed systems. And right now, they have nothing to teach. None of it works, and it's all dangling. And a good witness to that is Andrew Crystal. Listen to my dialogues with Andrew Crystal because he's there just starting off in academia, and he's up against this ridiculous police state they're forming themselves because they don't know, they have nothing to offer anymore. Every school, every futile attempt exhausts itself. Now, they could do something interesting. They could turn on the kids to Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan and Pynchon and James Ellroy and have them understand the present with just that kind of material. But they're not going to do it because the university's obsolete. So we're not trying to save them anyway. Let them all go.
Yeah, all these guys, Saul Bellow was was the most literate, most eloquent of that University of Chicago crowd, the Committee of Social Thought and all that with Bloom was involved with. And
they were objecting to Norman Mailer. See, they objected to Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, New York scene. They that was too dirty for them.
Right. I guess they might align with LaRouche in the sense that they didn't like the counterculture. They liked the culture. And in some sense, the counterculture is essentially a black op, or whatever, essentially authorized by Tavistock Institute or whatever they talk about, And I don't know what I'd like to hear David Worster's take on all that. But, if indeed there was nothing wrong with the original culture, in other words, if that were allowed to take its course – that just bypass the psychedelic counterculture and all that, or in the new left and all that, then that was their agenda all along. And Bellow is the most eloquent writer from that whole crowd. And
here's the thing about Bellow. He made a comment on McLuhan. He had to comment on McLuhan about 1970, 71, 72, and I read it at the time. He said that America, he was sort of shocked, I assume, that America was going way more, was going bohemian and going bohemian way beyond what McLuhan, he thought, advocated. He said, in other words, he thought McLuhan, I think, advocated the bohemianism, the counterculture, and then Bellow, just being in Chicago and watching America unfold in the early 70s, said, these guys are going way more bohemian than McLuhan ever imagined. But what he didn't know is that McLuhan didn't have a stodgy image of bohemianism and was ready for the 70s and was able to quickly make an aphorism about the streakers or whatever phenomenon, disco, way better than Saul Bellow. And so Bellow didn't understand that McLuhan was not a passing fanny as the Chicago guys thought he was. He was still in the game in the late 70s when Saul Bellow was trying to figure out what kind of novel he could write and get away with. So just a side thing I noticed about Bellow saying that.
Yeah, these guys were torn, but it's strange how they all, Bellow kind of got into the Rudolf Steiner track a little bit.
He went over the Thompson Quadrant. That's Thompson. Thompson is a great student of Rudolf Steiner.
Right. And
that traditional occult is the last gasp of visual space. The printed book goes esoteric. It's like your Paul Thoreau's brother. They go esoteric with occult notions of that are an effect of the phonetic alphabet to be the content of their literature. See?
Harold Bloom had this whole thing with the Kabbalah, right? I don't know how
they all the occult The mystery schools are the effect of the phonetic alphabet. I mean, tribal people, what Terence McKenna celebrates is pre-alphabetic. The tribes, the aborigines, they take the drugs and they're not worrying about any symbolism or any occult ritual. They're just having a good time and enjoying the hallucination. But when you start to get into the beginnings, the effects of writing and the phonetic alphabet, visual space starts coming up. Then Plato makes archetypes, and you have a preciousness about the taking of the drugs. You have a preciousness of the symbolism, and that's the Kabbalah and the mystery religions of the Hellenic period, and that's all a product of the phonetic alphabet. And Don Thiel and McLuhan understood that. And Don Thiel, that's why he valued me. I was the only person who could talk about that part of the occult. So when McLuhan is interested in the occult, he knows it's an effect of visual space. Saul Bellow, Bloom and them don't know that. The Rushkoffs and the Daniel Chinkbeck, what's his name? Pinchbeck. They're visually biased guys trying to, and, you know, Terence McKenna is very interesting in the middle of this. He wrote books, and at the end of his life, turned out to be his end of life, he started to get fascinated by McLuhan, and he never got a chance to fully get McLuhan, but he started celebrating McLuhan and Finney's wake in the, you know, the chaotic, ecstatic mode, not the print-a-book mode, but he still, very slightly, I think McKenna still wanted to be a writer. He still had that individualist tendency in him. But he had gone further than even Robert Anton Wilson.
Yeah, I think McKenna was looking, his endgame scenario was time wave zero and the I Ching and the machine elves.
Yeah, see, there it is. There's the visual space. Still trying to find an endpoint, the singularity, you know, the 2012, the time wave. He still had that little thread of visuality. Now, what's interesting is the dialogue between William Thompson and McKenna. Thompson, being a book guy in the end and an expert on the occult history of the book, he objects to lend it to Terence McKenna's orgyism. So when William Irwin Thompson took a break from teaching at the Cathedral of St. John Divine, and I used to attend those seminars in the early and middle 90s, he went to the Center of Integral Studies in San Francisco, and he came back a year later, and he writes about this in his introduction, Forward to Coming into Being, which comes out in 96, 97. That's where he starts hoiking up Finney's Wake and McLuhan belatedly. But he said when he encountered all these McKenna groupies or just kids who just wanted to take drugs at the Center of Integral Studies and were not interested in books at all, he got mad at McKenna. He says, McKenna is the fault here, and these guys are all into McKenna and not my stuff, and McKenna is just a seduction that will lead them nowhere. That's where Thompson becomes a neoconservative and objects to McKenna, and he can't keep up with McKenna. McKenna will go on to be popular. And McKenna, though, you know, bites the dust because he's going to be obsolesced by YouTube. But McKenna, you know, seems to win out in the 90s over Wilson and Thompson because McKenna is celebrating just the Generation X and the subsequent generation that live on drugs, any kind of drug.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So
he's
and I'm the only person in the middle of that. I could come into the Center of Integral Studies, and I could give a whole perspective on all this stuff and not get caught in an argument with McKenna. You know, McKenna wanted to talk to me in the last few months, but then he got sick, and he never found out what I had to say, but he was intrigued about what I had said about him. But the point is that you can make Croker interesting to the drug kids. You can make Thompson interesting. You make McLuhan. You make LaRouche interesting if you know how to do it. But you can't be identified with any one of those four. But I'd make a fascinating course, and I already do anyways. Any lucky drugged-out kid. We heard on Thursday we had one of these kids, Yuri, call in, and he recognized the appeal of what I was doing with Ion and what I'd done because he met Keith. Now, Keith is a kid born in 1983, and he's a good testament. If you read his posts on Five Body, you can find them. They're by either Kiggy or Hexbody. And he's there quadriphenically jumping from quadrant to quadrant imitating what he thinks I'm doing. And it's that. You could put him in one of those Central Integral Studies schools and he could be a little minor charismatic figure just because he would have a way of communicating to the quadriphenic, what I call Morpheus generation. Generation Y.
Yeah, he was trying to create an he was trying to create an anti-environment, it sounds like, to your
to me.
Body thing,
yeah.
Five body,
he,
yeah.
he tried to put me. He interpreted the Dobbs quadrant as having a particular bias. He was wrong, but I think he was too young to understand my comprehensive juggling. So he had to find one projected, you know, problem in what I was doing, so he could have something to bounce off of to have a youthful identity. And I understood that process.
Well, part of what I wanted to point out in the email is that, in other words, using the metaphor of Ryan returning to separateness, is that, I mean, what is the stance of a person within these cobwebs exchanging information as sort of an information input-output mechanism? And it gets into the efficacy of information exchange within this environment. Now, if the cobwebs are, in fact, disappearing through, you know, free energy or whatever, you know, cold fusion is kind of a bad term. That's kind of the
term. We'll call
the
it the hexadic. We move out of the pentadic into the hexadic.
Yeah. So, that, in other words, this thing is going to happen whether people know it or not, is, you know, or aware of it or whatever. So that, but there's still the question, and then that's why, you know, to me it gets down to those Jakobson levels of communication with the phatic and everything like that, because yes, phatic communion is the nest. I mean, that's what's going to happen across the board, even with like the Crocarian data trash, or whatever. It's in other words, you're going to have phatic.
Well, it became Manipian phatic. It became Manipian phatic in the 90s.
Yeah.
Now all that I said and you've said in the last few hours, we come back to the essence of Finnegan's Wake and what to do with it and how to live with Finnegan's Wake in a cold fusion hexadic environment. Listen to your statements. They actually are a good wrap up. You say Finnegan's Wake then becomes, and we could be just saying this right now, but you already wrote it. You said Finnegan's Wake then becomes a kind of baseline requirement of phatic communion. Now, I would add in Manipian phatic communion. And then you say, and interlocutors or intertactile agents engaging in such communion must be able to perceive the phaticness of the situation and avoid the trap of allowing the content to reify the cobwebs of separateness. Now, that's what I was just explaining to you, and then you were just starting to explain back to me. It's right here, what you're saying. Anybody who's listening closely to what we have said should understand this, what we're saying, what you wrote here. Then you say, the new Wakeian medium has been the ground since transition, meaning since the magazine transition in the 20s, right?
Yeah.
And in some sense, McLuhan and everyone else, Pynchon, Robert Anton Wilson, Norm Mailer, everybody, and even Zappa, are figures trying to catch up to this ground in order to perform. Another Kigye is trying to find something from there in order to perform as in any environment to me.
Right, but he knows about instant replay. That's the he's past global fear. He's in instant replay. And
no, exactly. And
small
and
theater, yeah.
He's a nano community.
Right.
So then you say the new wake. You say everyone has been trying to catch up to this Finnegan's Wake ground in order to perform. Joyce's intention seems clear and one of goodwill. And maybe I misinterpreted some things in trying to piece together, you write, all of these sources, yours, Joyce's, Ion's, and McLuhan's, but it does seem that the mortar is the message, is not a bad first attempt. Yes, the mortar is the message, and that is the essence of a big part of our public dialogue with Ion about the role of mortar. Remember I was saying that Ion is trying to get you to figure out how to use visual space, how to maintain identity in the middle of this, or at least the Western legacy. A seminar on that would be talking about the mortar as the message. Mortar, he's taking mortar as visual space, or that aspect of, mortar could be considered a mix, a grab bag of mixed corporate media, but the Westerner is trying to find a visual perspective in relation to it.
Well, let me throw this thing at you. When you were talking about the phonetic alphabet and the visual space and everything, it occurred to me to kind of connect that into something that I read about quantum theory of consciousness, with this idea that there's this guy Bernreuter, who's a big time neuroscientist, and that got into this. This idea of put the ions inside the neuron getting trapped, and that there's some sort of a like a switching going on there.
You're talking about the subatomic particle, the ion. He's actually addressing
the ion. I'm sorry, the ion. Yeah.
There's
theories of it's one of the prominent theories in neuroscience about the origin of consciousness and
they're starting to notice the role of the ion. Yeah, no, that's what we've done a lot, ion on that. I mean, there's a very practical reason why ion called itself ion. But, no, the ion is the missing link here. That is very interesting. You should send me whatever articles you have on that.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. It's a guy named Bernreuther. I don't know, he's from Europe. I don't know if he's from the Netherlands or somewhere, Germany. He talks about potassium ions getting trapped. And that there's this, and it's like this trapping mechanism that causes consciousness. And that somebody pointed out in an article on this, it's quantum entanglement. Somebody pointed out in a review of Bernreuther's idea that the shape of these ions reminded him of the Kabbalistic tree of life.
Fantastic.
This is
awesome.
Your
phone is blinking, right? It's running down.
Oh, it is. I'll plug it in.
No. Listen, I think we should come to an end. I don't want this to be too long. But what you're bringing up right now, let me read those articles. That's beautiful stuff. I can fucking do a lot with that stuff. I mean, we could make our next dialogue about that.
Because I was
thinking about the beginning of consciousness, and I won't say what I was thinking, but I was relating to the ionic process and some of the stuff I got from ion. But if you're finding stuff where one school of thought that's looking at that, the trapping of consciousness, that's perfect. That's really good.
But yes, the shape of these ions in there, there's like two doors that they can get out of, or something like that.
The shape is the mathematics that I'm telling you we learned from ion. That's the shaping.
But what I was thinking, though, is that the connection I made is that you talk about the phonetic alphabet, that other things are a projection of that. But what is the phonetic alphabet a projection of? And it may have to do with these ions getting trapped in these potassium ions. So, in other words, that humanity, I mean, it wasn't just Cadmus and the dragon's teeth and the phonetic alphabet. The idea that that code is some sort of manifestation of some deep structure within the neuron.
Okay, well, here's what it is. Okay. It's mathematics.
Right.
McLuhan says that number is tactile. So you move out of sculptural pre-literate pre-writing space, and you start to have writing in different forms, ideograms, syllabaries, and then it gets specialized later with the phonetic alphabet. But as the I starts to creep in, McLuhan used to say that the pyramids were built as a preservation of the huge or the in-depth or whatever non-visual spaces of tactile cultures. And as visuality started to creep in, they tried to visualize tactility, and they made these huge monuments. You know what I mean? Like the pyramids.
Yeah.
So that was a sensory explanation of this borderline between the receding tactile culture starting to move towards the eye. Now, number and rhythm and music would be the interplay. And so the visualization of number, and Ion talks about how they originally wrote number, like you take the number 7 and put that little cross on the vertical bar of 7, because you have to have 7 angles in the shape known as 7. There's 2 angles in 2. 3 angles in 3, you write it jaggedly or sharply. Anyways, I'm saying that math is the beginning of visual culture, and Kabbalah goes into number and numerology and that stuff. The numbering is the first way you register visuality and imprint it on tactility, on a tactile culture. That's what I bet you we're getting here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That there's a mathematic. And this is the mathematics, the sine cosine stuff that Ion talks about. That numbering, that shaping of tactile space or the non-physical, the beginning of the shaping of it leads to the phonetic alphabet or to Pythagoras or the Kabbalah, the sacralizing of number.
Right.
You see?
Yeah.
It's sacralizing the tactile space visually. So a number is a visualization of tactile space. That's neat, and that's a profound statement. So I think we should end on that point, because we've been going for almost 3 hours, and I got to do some other stuff.
Sure.
But it's been an awesome conversation, and I think a few people will enjoy it. And we should look up. Let's go into this ion quantum entanglement thing, because I've done stuff with ion about the role of the ion in the nucleus, in the atom.
Yeah.
It's really important.
Yeah, it deals with the synapses and all this stuff. Yeah, I'll send you the links on it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, there's also the Penrose thing with the, Penrose Hammerhoff. And Hammerhoff, they had orchestrated object reduction, which is another theory. I'll send you those links, too.
Yeah, now Hammerhoff, I think, is the guy that William Thompson, he likes to grab scientists and bring them into the Lindisfarne Fellowship. And so he grabbed Hammerhoff, I think.
Right. Because he wrote something with Deepak. Yeah.
He works with Chopra?
Yeah, Chopra. He wrote something with Deepak Chopra. It's called Quantum Soul, a Scientific Hypothesis. Send you that one.
Right.
See,
that's where in the Thompson quadrant, they ultimately are visually biased guys. And so a scientist is visually biased. And so Thompson grabs a scientist who will end up writing about New Age topics, because that's Gnosticism or the effective phonetic alphabet. The scientists aren't aware of that. The Fritzhoff Capras don't know their bias.
Yeah. You know, I just found something else searching for this year. There's this other guy, Andrei Trenikov, that wrote something very interesting called P-Adical Dynamical Thinking in the Freudian Unconscious. Now, he has equations for human emotions, like jealousy, whatever, stuff like that, love. He expresses it mathematically, and I just found, I didn't know he was connected to this whole quantum brain thing either, too. So he's got some stuff on that, and to see how that ties together. But the most interesting thing in terms of the theories is this potassium ion trapping thing, because it gets more mathematical than some of these other theories, where they talk about like a gap or something.
Right.
And,
does he talk about a gap, or the others talk about a gap?
Yeah, the other ones like a bubble or something like that. They're talking about a bubble, which the Penrose stuff. I haven't looked into it that much, but the potassium ion thing seems to be seems to have legs, So.
Okay.
All right.
We'll
talk about it.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Alton. And just hold on here I will stop the recording just a second. So that was really good. And so I hit *9. Oh, I think Carolyn's listening. Carolyn, get off the phone. If she's on, it doesn't work. Are you there, Alton?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just try it again. Yeah, there it is.